For years, the Royal's wealth has been shrouded in secrecy. Now, Dispatches has discovered what they haven't told you, and how much it's costing us to keep Charles and William rich. The King, the Prince and their secret millions. Dispatches on Channel 4.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, just after 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 14th of November 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol City Centre. It looks like we'll be saying goodbye to our present studio, sort of come bathroom basement today. Last time here for a while, I think so. We'll be on the road, pulling our caravan gypsies again over the next few weeks. Don't believe a word we say, but do try to share. We do try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar port turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the city of London's Masonic Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com from 11am to half past 2 in the afternoon central time, 97.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from GitHub. Easiest place to find your way there is straight to thisweek.org.uk, or just put Not the BCFM Politics Show into GitHub. It's also on the Apple App Store, but not, of course, the evil Google Play. Oh, we would not taint Google Play with our wonderful app, would we, Nick? No. Nick's the developer, by the way. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with accelerationist zero trust agendas, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify. BBC Verify, they didn't verify the Donald Trump edit, did they? Or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the rentier class, World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to multiplying crises, Gaza, housing, Ukraine, COVID, prisons, migrants, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, COP, their twisted accelerationist, Armageddonist solutions are crafted to make every crisis worse. Have the cabinet sold their souls to the devil because the politicians have got nothing to say? Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment, Social Darwinist Control Freaks and Underlings want us slaves to their AI. Or maybe just dead, eh? Albert Pike's World War III plan is a big taboo. Don't talk about that. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Chaos King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, anyone who's not their mates. In fact, the Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, and the only right they want us to have is our so-called right to kill ourselves, with the help, like the jabs, of a doctor. Netanyahu, king of chaos again, another one, rolling out a blood-red carpet for the Zionist man, God, Messiah, Antichrist to come, is he? But it's not the end of the world, or is it? Helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich here in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll be hearing, finally, I actually recorded the interview a couple of weeks ago with Hedley Rees about his new book about the pharmaceutical industry and their supply chain, developing and producing drugs, what's wrong with it and how to fix it. Plus, we have an update from Nick Georges in Egham about his attack by a Tommy Robinson far-right nutcase the police don't seem to want to investigate, even though it was a GBH assault. And also a bit from David Halpin about the weird use of potential nuclear weapons or radiation weapons of one sort or another by the Israelis. So Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. Also us here, cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft by the trans lobby. But not cancelled from here yet. Right, welcome to the Bristol Politics Show, which we're slowly but surely starting to drop this idea of Not the BCFM and calling it that. Martin, we're going to start this week with a critique, I think, of the economy. Last week we talked about Yanis Varoufakis, didn't we, about what's going on with Rachel Reeves. Rachel Reeves today has started saying that, oh no, I'm not going to tax income. Now, obviously, a very basic fact to do with the current situation in Britain is one would not want to to tax work. Anything to do with people getting people into jobs, is that should not be taxed. And it seems like the penny may have finally dropped that it's a bad idea to raise income tax, because that's a tax on work.
Yeah, that's but if you're not going to have wealth taxes, you're stuck with income taxes, which is why we've had them since the Napoleonic Wars.
Well, so one of the things that they're now talking about doing is taxing savings. So people who've got, you know, this is a disincentive to save and an incentive to spend. And the idea being...
How are they going to tax savings, Tony?
Isn't it interest on savings or something?
Well, I don't know. You've got to specify what you mean.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm telling you. Taxing savings, you know what that is, don't you? Money in the bank.
Yeah, but the ISAs were set up years ago by the Tories, which means you don't have to pay tax on any kind of
Maybe they'll just get rid of those, eh? Or maybe they'll
Any until the Tories brought them in. You had to pay tax on savings.
That's what we call taxing savings. Yes. Yeah? So that, is it a good idea to stop people saving, get rid of the incentives to save money?
Yeah, well, that's what we're doing now with the
Because then people spend it, don't they?
Yeah, that's
right. And the economy starts to go.
That's right, and that's how the economy used to function. And, of course, the top rate of income tax in this country when the economy functioned properly in the 1950s, the good old days, was 95%. And there was a super tax and inheritance taxes as well. And
can
now
you just
we can't
say,
afford
can you
anything.
Answer, actually, look, try answering the question for a change, which is it a good idea to tax savings? Now, people
should tax
trying to
wealth.
Sack... But if people are trying to save, for example, save for a car, should you tax that?
Not necessarily.
Maybe they should just buy, do it on tick.
What we need to do is tax
Higher
wealth,
purchase.
Tony. We need inheritance Higher, taxes.
Yeah, look, I'm not talking about. You see, I know this is what you want to talk about. I'm not even asking about that. You've said this, I don't know, however many times just now. Tax wealth. We understand that. But what about taxing savings?
Is savings are wealth, aren't they?
Well, say, for example, 30-40 grand to buy a car,
so
200,000 to buy a house. Should that be taxed?
All saving is wealth, is it not? So if we're going to tax wealth, we're talking about taxing
you
savings.
You are talking about taxing everyone, really, rather than the rich, just everyone.
Well, in actual fact, because capitalism works like this, everybody who works has to pay PAYE, yeah? They don't even get to decide to put in a tax return. It's just taken off them before they
It's exactly the same with taxes on interest, isn't it? That interest gets taken off by the bank. You don't get involved.
That's right, but that's not a tax. That's interest.
Tax of interest.
Yeah, you don't tax interest.
They do tax interest.
How do they tax interest, Tony?
They tax it. If they don't tax it if it's in an ISA, but they do if it's not in an ISA.
No, yeah. What's happening in an ISA is your savings are not taxed.
The point of it is, can you please just address the actual issue, which is they're disincentivising people to put money in bank accounts and incentivising people to go and put it in stocks and shares.
That's the whole point of ISAs. But, of course, what it's doing is actually financialising people's savings. In Japan, in the 1950s, most people kept their money in the post office in cash, and they took it out in cash. And those savings were the basis of investment in Japanese industry. But there's no reason why any savings should be taxed on all your wealth. And if most people do not save anything. A large proportion of people in this country have got no savings at all. No ISA, no nothing. Mm. They've got an overdraft.
I mean, it just seems to me sensible to encourage people to save. But anyway, you know, because
not in the Keynesian view.
That means
not in the Keynesian view. You want to encourage the marginal propensity to consume.
You want just to get so they don't actually accumulate wealth. That's actually the World Economic Forum view, isn't it? We don't want people to have
anything.
It's
also the view in Cuba, Tony. People don't inherit any wealth, but everybody gets everything for free. It's called communism.
Is it the view in Germany?
No, but Germany isn't a communist country.
No. Anyway, let's have a listen to Yanis Varoufakis. I was a bit cheeky last week because we were discussing this piece on the World Service with Varoufakis about his book Techno-Feudalism. And the... But I inserted it into... You might have heard it if you're listening to the longer podcast because it's such an interesting piece. So let's just have a listen to the tail end of that from this time last week. Yanis Varoufakis talking on the World Service about the massive $1 trillion payout that Elon Musk's shareholders have awarded him if he jumps through these various loops, which he obviously will. So he's going to get his nice $1 trillion and use it to fund Tommy Robinson. This is the ironic thing, isn't it? This is why Musk is so important. He's calling for violence on British streets and actually saying that it's going to happen. And he's funding Tommy Robinson to actually encourage violence.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we should be pointing that out. And when the violence happens, we're going to blame him, aren't we?
Yanis Varoufakis, just a final word from you. I mean, do you think we're heading for a fall? We're about to fall off a cliff edge?
There's no doubt that a big one is coming. But then again, this is capitalism. It produces crises like it produces iPhones and Tesla cars. Allow me a comment to say that, Martin, I trust you keep the capitalist face, like I keep the socialist face. But both you and I are irrelevant today because this is no longer capitalism, certainly not socialism. What it is a system in which a new form of capital, a produced means of behavioral manipulation, not a produced means of production, is taking over, and it is replacing markets, and it is replacing profits, and it is replacing them with cloud fiefdoms and a form of cloud rent, which is feudal in its substance. So, yes, people like us, I think we're becoming obsolete.
Well, I think you can say we've moved into an age of monopoly seeking as opposed to genuine competition. But as each of these titans of tech seek a monopoly in their field, the risk to them is the next guy comes along, knocks them out, you know.
And it's worse than that, Martin. Monopolies. It's worse. They're not seeking a monopoly. They're replacing the market altogether with something, a fiefdom that they own, from which they extract the rent. This is no longer the time of Henry Ford and Westinghouse.
Yanis Varoufakis there, economist. I was also speaking to Martin van der Weyer, business editor of The Spectator. You're listening to NewsHour.
So that's NewsHour last Friday's World Service. But, I mean, it's an interesting point Varoufakis is making with this guy from The Spectator there. He's saying they're replacing the market altogether with a fiefdom that they own.
Well, that's Varoufakis's particular take on it all. And, of course, it's got a certain attraction as a way of analysing
things.
Talking
about cloud rent, and basically everybody is going to be in hock to these people. They're just owners. They're actually owners of a lot. I mean, this is one of the reasons, you know, we have a little bit of a dispute about savings. I think if people don't actually have any wealth, their savings have been eroded, then of course, they are completely in hock to whoever owns the infrastructure that they need. And that was all privatised by Margaret Thatcher.
That's true, but lots of people, as I said earlier, don't have any savings, so that perhaps they should, but they don't earn enough to have any. And that's always been true going back into history. Many people, you know, ordinary people having savings is actually a relatively modern thing. They used to live hand to mouth, week to week, day to day.
Do you want to go back there then?
No, I don't. I'm just saying that.
Well, we're going back there, aren't we?
They're doing is they're shifting the burden of social taxes and all the rest of it from wealthy people to poor people. That's what they've been doing all along. That's what they're still doing.
What just strike me is when the budget happens and everyone is being encouraged to invest in stocks and shares. This, of course, is a casino. And it could just collapse any time.
Well, that's the whole thing about ISAs, is it encourages people to put their money into stocks and shares instead of putting it in the post
office. ISAs don't do that. The idea is you put it into the ISA every year.
And then what do you think the people do with the ISA? They invest it in the stock market. That's the whole point.
It goes from there. No, actually, it depends who it is.
Well, that's right.
It all depends who it is. So if the ISA is with the co-op, for example, they don't necessarily invest it in the stock market. A lot of the ISA money is going into mortgages, for example.
Yes.
And it's helping people buy homes.
All right, but the point is that you're not. What you're doing is encouraging people to speculate in them, you know, because you don't know what people are doing with your ISA. It's not like you decide what you're going to invest it in.
Yes, it is. Every ISA will come, I'm sure, as all savings account. I've been to the co-op and asked them, I said, where does this money get invested? And they show you, right, this is where it goes.
Yes.
And if I want to go to HSBC or Barclays, you know what, I'll get a higher rate of interest. Because they invest in the arms trade. And they just say, oh, we invest in anything.
Okay, so in other words, you can invest in the co-op and get a lower return because they're investigating mortgages, or you can put your ISA in HSBC and you can make much more money
on drugs
and whatever it is. Now, the point is, this is part of the neoliberalisation of the state.
Is it being flippant to say that it's drug money at HSBC? Because I think they have links, haven't they?
All of the big banks are absolutely up to their eyeballs in drugs money, we all know that, and the arms industry and all the rest of it. What's happened is the financialization and of the society over our lifetimes. And what used to happen, as I say, in Japan in the 1950s, everybody saved their money, and they have a high savings ratio in Japan. It's caused a problem for their economy, actually. But they have a high savings ratio, but it was all put in the post office at very low rates of interest and made available to companies to invest in industrial technology. That's not what we're doing here. And of course, maybe if she does decide, I don't know whether she is going to decide that, to get rid of the tax relief on ISAs, that would be a better thing to do than increase income tax on poor people. Yeah, because definition, people with ISAs are people who've got money to save. Yeah.
So yeah, and it isn't just poor people we're talking about here.
Well,
is
it's anybody,
so,
isn't
for
it?
Example, the National Insurance Employers Contribution increase. There's loads of family businesses, farms, and things like that that this is affecting that are actually quite marginal. You know, because of the increased monopolisation, increased energy prices, loads of family businesses have become, only just a little bit profitable. So you may have quite a lot of assets, as the farmers keep pointing out, but your profits aren't very high, and so. A bit extra national insurance is quite possible that thousands of those marginal businesses, which are keeping people unemployed but not making vast amounts of money, may go under with the national insurance increase.
Well, the main problem Rachel Reeves's got is this stupid financial straitjacket she created in order to appease the bond markets and all the rest of it. And obviously the answer to that is actually to change the way in which money's created and also wealth taxes and redistribution.
This is what we heard, that's right.
Not on workers,
exactly.
On wealthy people.
We heard this from Steve Hall, for example, didn't we? Look, just get out of this crazy obsession with growth good or bad, or for good or ill, my country right or wrong. You should start thinking about utilising the government's actual power to print money, create money, and to start to put it into parts of society that you want to be a success and to start to grow. What the situation that we're in, it seems now, is that these private equity firms have successfully, after 2008, become actually more powerful than governments are. And they are actually, along with the City of London, private equity firms like BlackRock are really setting the policy now.
Well, they always were, but it's got more advanced, because, of course, the more powerful they get, the more powerful they are. And that's what's happening. I mean, the Labour Party won the election last year on the basis that they weren't going to rock the boat and they were just going to work within the system as it was. Now, of course, the problem with that is that the system as it was and as it is actually in total crisis. So it's very unlikely that she's going to be able to, A, either to balance the books or to make growth happen. Because when you've blown up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and there's an AI bubble through the roof, growth is likely to be a bit elusive. There's more likely to be a crash.
Can they just put train and bus prices up and electricity prices and gas prices? There'll be growth then, won't they? Even though people will be screaming.
Yes, that's right, because everything... what growth means, crudely, is anything anybody spends any money on. What we really need is growth in some things, like people on low incomes need to have a growth in income, and a reduction in other things, like wasteful expenditure on nuclear weapons, which we're never going to use. All of these things are choices that society makes. And, of course, when we debate these things, you've got to be responsible. You've got to so-called balance the books and all the rest of it. You saw Nigel Farage the other week just saying, well, we can't have any tax cuts, even though we promised £90 billion of tax cuts in the last election. It turns out we can't do any of that.
But he was saying sensible things like maybe this money can be printed by the government rather than borrowed from the big banks. And it's what we used to call the merchant banks. But rather than borrowing this massive amounts of money that we have to pay interest on, we can just create it ourselves. And he at least said that.
He did. And so, in other words, the debate is now opening up. People who are going to vote for the national rally in France next year.
It got shut down pretty quickly, that one.
Well, it's opened the door to a certain extent, because the right wing all over the world now really isn't the free market, isn't what their people want. And, of course, it isn't what their people want. People didn't vote for Farage to have more deregulation, which has ruined the economy over 40 years. He's going on about that. If we just deregulate the economy some more, then there'll be growth.
Well, they can't deregulate it anymore. They've got rid of Ofwat, which is the most important bit to regulate. They've got rid of it. Some guy, I may even have a clip about that. But this deregulation is incredibly dangerous, isn't it? Because it just means that you've got actually a form of anarcho-capitalism.
It does, and of course, the idea that the social coalition that Reform are trying to build, that all these people in the so-called Red Wall who used to vote Labour are in favour of more deregulation, and that you see, we haven't got enough entrepreneurship. You see, people like Nigel, who's actually made £1.4 million this year on his other work, apart from being an MP, which he gets paid £94,000 for. I was watching a very interesting clip about all of his little interests. How much time does he have to be an MP if you're earning 1.4 million on the side? But of course, the 1.4 million on the side, he doesn't have to work for, really. He doesn't have to do anything for
am
it.
I right
it just
in, am I
goes
right
into
in
his
saying,
bank account.
Am I right in saying this, that when everything was privatised, all these regulators were set up for every single industry, that the intention was always to collapse those regulators, to infiltrate them? I mean, things like the Monopolies and Mergers Commission, organisations like this have virtually been neutered now.
Well, that's right. Of course, that's the whole point. I mean, you didn't need to regulate nationalised industries because they were run by the government and they had various targets that they had to meet. Once you've put it in the hands of the private sector, then you have to regulate it because otherwise they're going to rip you off. But if you're going to rip you off, you might as well just run it yourself, which is the logic of nationalisation, which to some extent Nigel Farage has come back to, except that we can't have a nationalised steel industry in this country because of the international situation and the tariffs on our steel, it's finished. We're not going to be producing steel in this country ever again. It's over.
What about the obvious ones like the water one, which is gone, and Ofgem, the gas and electricity ones?
Well, the point about the thing about regulators, they can be captured, yeah. So the idea that the regulator will somehow be independent of the industries that they're regulating, it's just not the case. You know, they are basically captured by the industries that they're regulating, and in any case, all you're doing is saying we'll let you have that much profit rather than that much profit. But if it was run by the government, if there's any profit, that could go into the government's coffers for all things that they might want to do. You know, I mean, the nationalised rail industry, for example, was able to subsidise rural lines by creaming off profits from the intercity.
Yeah, which meant that the network was much better used because it was more extensive.
Yes, that's right. In other words, that's the whole logic of having a planned economy as opposed to letting the market decide.
You're a socialist, aren't you? You're one of those evil socialists that the Americans are so afraid of. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the guy who did actually abolish Ofwat. And I keep coming across his name. His name's Steve Reed. I think he's something like the business minister or I don't know. But anyway, I'll check that out while we have a listen to him talking about why we've just got to get rid of the water regulator. Never mind. I mean, the alternative was much better, wasn't it? In fact, it was renationalising water. And then the bills wouldn't have gone up. But this is really a sop to the people who have been sucking money out of the water industry for shareholders, isn't it?
It is. Of course it is. And there's no reason why they should get anything. They should just lose their money because they've made a mess of it.
The whole thing's been refinanced. Another bunch of people have come in. If you're doing this and this and this, and you increase the bills, blah, blah, that's why they've had to get rid of Ofwat, isn't it, I guess?
Yes.
Okay, let's have a listen to Steve Reed now talking about this earlier this year.
It restored accountability by giving the regulators more teeth with a ban on unfair bonuses, severe and automatic penalties for breaking the law, and jail sentences for serious offences. Second, we've launched one of the biggest infrastructure projects in British history to clean up our rivers, lakes and seas. £104 billion of private sector investment will rebuild the water network, upgrading crumbling pipes, repairing leaks, and building new sewage treatment works around the country.
So there's a little taste of this guy. He's the environment minister, so he's the one
currently yeah, environment minister.
Yeah. These ones change so often. I actually thought Miliband was no, but he's climate secretary. Yeah. So they have a climate secretary and an environment secretary nowadays. So that's Steve Reed. And I think keep an eye open for this guy. He seems to be all the way around sort of dodgily turning Britain into a place which is just run by BlackRock.
Well, quite likely. I don't know that much about him. I didn't realise that Ofwat was actually to be got rid of completely. That sounds absurd to
me. I think it's gone. I mean, it's just what they've done, I think, is created some government office which is supposedly doing much better than they were.
Ofwat hadn't made a very good job of it. I do remember reading something about that. So they're saying, well, you obviously haven't regulated them properly, so we're going to do something else with it. They should just renationalise it, as you say. There's no case for it to be in the private sector in the first place.
No. Anyway, another area which is desperately in need of privatisation is the pharmaceutical industry. Sorry, nationalisation. And Hedley Rees is a writer, a researcher from Wales, who popped up quite a bit occasionally on the mass media during COVID, pointing out the massive problems that there were in the way that the COVID... well, the jabs, basically, not, I won't call them vaccines, the COVID jabs were developed and released to the public. He has a lot to say in this, in the longer version of this interview, about June Rain, who is the boss of the UK regulator. So again, it's regulation we're talking about, but anyway, very ineffective regulation, really spineless people doing the regulation. And so Hedley's new book is called Transforming the Pharmaceutical Supply Chain. So in typical Hedley fashion, rather than just cursing the pharmaceutical industry for poisoning people and coming up with extremely dodgy drugs that are just designed to line the pockets of shareholders and to entertain shareholders and sort of have a watch swinging backwards and forwards in front of shareholders, he thinks there should be a complete and utter rehash of the way that drugs are developed and also the way they're actually manufactured once they've been approved.
The target market they asked me to address in this book was graduates, postgraduates, professionals, and it could include lawyers and accountants, finance people, and researchers. So I've written the book, and it includes a new paradigm for developing drugs. Once I've gone through how the industry works, how you manage supply chain strategically, I then introduce a new paradigm for developing drugs, which brings doctors, clinicians, back into the drug development process. You know, in COVID, some well-known doctors were using ivermectin as a drug, and they were saying they were having positive results with patients with respiratory conditions. But it couldn't be used because it wasn't licensed for a respiratory indication. But doctors, if they knew how the supply chain worked, they could actually do that, because they know the clinical part, the safety part, the pharmacokinetics and everything. So if they are helped to build a supply chain, they could repurpose drugs like ivermectin. And there's, 90% of these drugs these days are out of patent. So a doctor could, if he's seeing good data, or a network of doctors particularly, if they're seeing good data on an existing generic drug, then they could repurpose that. And they would likely be more concerned about the patient benefit rather than the profit benefit.
Well, look, yeah, but you've just mentioned the word, the magic word, out of patent. You know, this is seems to be the problem. If it's out of patent, there's not the big money behind it to drive it through, Hedley. That seems to be the main difficulty here. But also, of course, we've got to separate the two things out. Maybe you can clarify to the extent to which your book goes into actually developing these pharmaceutical products in the first place, or is it just about the actual manufacture? Because you may be manufacturing something which is killing people.
They've got these accelerated pathways, particularly for rare disease products, that which are gene-modified cell therapies using CRISPR, which is still purely experimental, and they put in accelerated pathways for those because they are for people who've got no other solution to their genetic condition. But they do kill people. There's a lot of evidence. So I'm absolutely on board with that. Acceleration has been going through the MHRA and all regulatory authorities except for the FDA for years.
And is the reason it's not going through the FDA because of RFK Jr.?
Yes, because before that, there was a guy called Dr. Peter Marks, who was in charge of the vaccines and other biologics. He was in charge of the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. And the first thing Robert Kennedy Jr. did was to fire Peter Marks. And it's the best thing he could ever have done, because Marks was just waving through all these products. And these vaccines have been on the market since 2017. That's in Marx's tenure as well. And they were originally for rare diseases with a technology called CAR T-cell, where they take an animal cell, they modify its DNA and create a small, what they call a plasmid, which is a small strip of DNA, and then that goes into the patient's body, and they use that for these CAR T therapies. The only thing is, the first one approved by the FDA in August 2017 was a drug from Novartis, which is one of the biggest pharma companies in the world, called Kymriah. And aside from it costing $475,000 for one treatment, the side effects are horrific. And, you know, there's an FDA, the FDA package insert describes the side effects as neurological toxicities, cytokine release syndrome, sepsis, and secondary cancers. So what they did, they took those CAR T therapies that weren't selling for those two reasons, cost and side effects, and they called them vaccines. And they just rebranded them. And even knowing they had those side effects, they still took them to market, and there's so much wrong with it, it's hard to believe. It's about the whole development process, from non-clinical testing. What people don't realise is that what goes into the patient's body is made by the supply chain. And what they did in COVID, they ignored the supply chain and just measured clinical effectiveness, and they did all the development process at the same time. Now, you can't do that. You've got to do it in stages. You know, you've got to do small supply chain, testing animals, then testing humans, bigger supply chain. So all the time you're having to make sure that the supply chain is at least safe and is going to produce an effective product. So I go through all that. And what I've also done is the last chapter is a section on saying what needs to happen to change this. And the first thing is to change the law on patenting drugs, because up until the 1980s, you had to have a process patented that produced the drug at scale. You were never able to say, oh, I've got this molecule, I think it's going to cure Alzheimer's, or will you give me a patent? Oh, yes, you can have that patent. And then they start to develop it and realize, oh, no, our theory about it isn't working. So that's gone into the valley of death. And then
what you've just said there is like a bombshell, really. So if someone can find a way of making something much, much better and easier and cheaper than one of these big drug companies, they're not allowed to patent that anymore, and they're not allowed to say they're not allowed to produce this. So how that sounds absolutely amazing to me, that, you know, I would think it's normal for you to be able to patent a process to make something, not the thing that's the molecule that's been produced in the first place. Because, I mean, that molecule may have an effect, but if someone can find a better way to make it, surely they should be able to patent that.
Yeah, they've got this concept called the mechanism of action. So for Alzheimer's, the mechanism of action is that a compound called amyloid beta wraps itself around brain cells and that sort of thing. And there have been 30 failed Alzheimer drugs in the last 15 years, and failed at a late stage, so when there's probably billions of dollars been paid to develop them. But, you know, it's a nonsense to get a patent for something that you don't know it's going to be made. You know, if I keep using the analogy that if you went into the patent office and said, look, I've got a molecule that you could use to make rubber that would help the tires hold the road better, you'd be out on your backside, because they say, well, you know, if you don't know how to make it, then, you know, come back when you do.
That's Hedley Reese there, talking about his new book, which is obviously wonderful. Hedley is, of course, a super lovely guy. It's called Transforming the Pharmaceutical Supply Chain. So he's somebody that was a big, big figure in the industry, actually. He was going to all the conferences, that sort of thing, working for the big pharmaceutical companies, until it became clear during COVID that it actually wasn't about quality. It was actually about profits.
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's been about profits all along. Obviously, during COVID, there was massive profit taking.
He was certainly getting work in these big pharmaceutical companies. And even if they didn't take his advice, they were certainly interested in what he had to say about how to develop drugs safely and how to produce them safely. But now, apparently not.
Well, obviously, what the COVID crisis did is it allowed them to push through stuff which would never have been allowed to be pushed through under normal circumstances. So it was a disaster capitalism on an enormous global scale, wasn't it?
So I will have a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later on this evening. I just find Hedley fascinating in that it's so wonderful that there is somebody doing what he's doing, because most people have just given up and walked away. It's the same in many industries, actually, that people with integrity are shown the door. Or elbowed out or nudged out of the way. And another thing I saw recently, this is the Jimmy Dore show. One of his mates, John Kiriakou, pops up on the Jimmy Dore show from time to time, had some interesting things to say, or at least I found them interesting, about diabetes. Because in the back of my mind there, I'm thinking about when he's talking about these mega expensive Alzheimer's drugs. We chatted several years ago with a guy called Dr. Chris Exley, who's known as Mr. Aluminium, and he was saying that this is actually one of the major causes is the amount of aluminium in the environment, particularly in diet, is one of the major causes of Alzheimer's. Anyway, this is fairly well known, but it's not really talked about very much in the industry, because the aluminium industry is a very powerful industry and it doesn't want to be not selling aluminium and extracting aluminium for all sorts of things, including, by the way, jabs. Many of the jabs have got aluminium in it. Anyway, so one way you can get rid of aluminium, he says, is to drink water which is high in the mineral silica, such as Volvic water. And if you drink your Volvic water, you won't need to have all these billion-dollar drugs, because that will be helping your body get the aluminium out of your system. So that seems to be a far, far better way to deal with these things. Anyway, so as I said, let's have a listen to this guy, John Kiriakou, speaking on the Jimmy Dore show about he has discovered what he thinks is discovered, and don't believe a word we say, of course, some very interesting way to deal with diabetes.
I've had diabetes for 21 years.
Oh, really?
And it got bad, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. I exercise every day, I eat right, and then in 2021, I just started gaining weight inexplicably. I went to the doctor, I said, I've never been this fat in my life. He said, oh, it's the insulin. But your diabetes is so bad, we have to do something radical, he said. So he sent me an article from The Lancet, written by a Scottish surgeon. A Scottish surgeon wrote a paper and said he had this woman with uncontrolled diabetes who also had stomach cancer. So he cut her open, took the stomach completely out, and like magic, in 24 hours, her pancreas started working again and started making insulin.
What?
So I called this guy in Scotland and I paid him for his time. I interviewed him. He said, yeah, we don't understand why it happens, but it's like a cure for diabetes. I said, is there anybody in the United States doing this? He said, yeah, there's a guy in New York. So I made an appointment and called that guy. Said exactly the same thing. We don't know why this works, but it does. I said, are there any side effects? He said, it may make your hair fall out. So I said,
I'd take it. That's a good trade-off, though.
Yeah, I'll take it, because the other guy told me I'm going to be dead in 5 years.
Oh.
So I said, is there anybody in Washington doing it? He introduces me to a surgeon there. The guy says, look, this is experimental, so insurance won't pay for it. I took out a loan, and I did it. They took my stomach out. Within 24 hours, I was off insulin.
No kidding.
Uh-huh. Within 9 months, I was off all diabetes medications. My hair has thinned, but I don't have diabetes anymore, and I lost 115 pounds.
No kidding.
Wait, what about you? They took your stomach out? Is that what you're saying?
Took it out. And I said to the surgeon, I said, so what did you do? You like cut me open? And he said, no. He said, I shaved your belly. I sat 10 feet away and the robot did it all. And I was like, cool. They made 2 1-inch incisions. I said, how'd you get it out of there like that? He said, well, you've been on a liquid diet for 10 days. He said, there was nothing to it. I just took it right out.
And so now when you eat, what happens?
They made a little pouch out of my small intestine right here that holds a quarter cup, which is so small that I have to say, like, oh, it's it's 2 o'clock. I haven't eaten anything yet today. I should probably eat something. I'm never, ever hungry. Never.
So they made like a fake stomach out of your small intestine? Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to know.
Well, anyway, listen, don't try this one at home, folks. But this is an interesting, isn't it interesting to hear? So the guy has his stomach taken out and his diabetes disappears. So, I mean, surely there are lots and lots of procedures in the medical profession, particularly fed by the pharmaceutical industry, which actually cause dependency on various drugs and various treatments and procedures. So the idea is to get you dependent on something rather than to cure you, it seems to me.
Well, that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think people, insiders in the pharmaceutical industry, have always basically made that clear. They're not, because it's a private sector exercise, and of course, it's not just entirely private sector, of course, because there are healthcare budgets all over the world, and they just batten in on those, you know. I mean, the vaccines were only rolled out because the government paid for them all, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to make any money at it. But of course, they're always looking for ways in which to get you dependent on what they're producing. They don't want to cure anything particularly, because if you cure it, then you know, this is why Cuban medicine is so interesting, because it's absolutely not for profit, and they've got one of the best medical systems in the world.
That's what we used to have here, by the way, and that was also talked about in the 1960s, 70s and 80s as the best in the world.
It was, but what's been happening since then is that there's been a huge, I mean, the National Health Service concept has been gradually undermined by things like hospital trusts and all the internal
markets. Do you know what else is causing so much trouble? Is this woman, Nicole Junkerman, who is running something called, I think is NHS Data. And so much more of the NHS budget is going towards this AI crunching analytics, which is supposed to analyze people's health, say, oh, look, we're going to come up with much better health outcomes for the whole country in the long term. But it is megally expensive. And by the way, Nicole Junkerman is somebody who Johnny Vedmore, someone over in Cardiff, he's an investigative journalist, one of the best, I think, certainly in the UK. He was the one that initially dug out all the information about the origins of Klaus Schwab family in the German Nazi nuclear program, which is a whole can of worms in itself, a rabbit hole that the Nazis were doing lots and lots on developments of nuclear weapons that was kept very secret at the end of the Second World War, as Todd Ryder has pointed out in many of his presentations. Anyway, let's go back to looking at the pharmaceutical industries. I find this fascinating. And listen, there's nothing, you know, I don't believe a word we say, but there's nothing to stop people going into, when you're in a supermarket, going through the various types of bottled water, or even finding out and doing an analysis of your own water that's coming through the tap, and looking at all the various minerals that are in there, and seeing which are the ones that are good. And particularly silica, by the way, is really good for helping your body getting rid of aluminium and stopping you getting Alzheimer's. So that's why it's worth, you know, there's certainly no harm in doing that, is there? We're going to have a little look at COVID now, but look back at COVID, because one of the big stories during COVID that we were covering, and Tess Laurie pointed out, Dr. Tess Laurie, based in Bath at the time, is now all going all around the world talking about the lessons learned from COVID. She was the first one to point out to me, anyway, the use of this out of patent drug called ivermectin, and how useful it is actually to stop viruses taking you, or like whether it's a cold, whether it's a COVID, a coronavirus, because it's got something in it which stops those nasty little viruses, which people like David Icke think don't exist. And Mike Yeadon, by the way, my God, you know, there's all these people that have fallen hook, line and sinker for this, that it stops them actually reproducing within your body. So it stops those little things attaching to your cells, injecting your cells with their own DNA, and then basically turning your nice little healthy cell into loads and loads of little viruses to then start spreading around in your body. So ivermectin is really good at doing this. It does other things as well. It's a dewormer of some kind. But anyway, let's have a listen to Dr. John Campbell. He's the guy who sort of, he was very big during COVID, and he does a regular series. He's a bit of a star on YouTube, and he's always, they're always threatening to demonetize him, take his channel down, and this sort of thing. But anyway, he's not a medical doctor, but he is extremely good on all these pharmaceutical matters, including he takes a look at ivermectin here.
Now, people that are low on vitamin D should probably take some of this. Again, your doctor will prescribe this for you, I'm sure, unless, of course, he doesn't. This is 0.266 milligrams. That's about 10,000 units, I guess, of calcifediol, which, of course, is the activated form of vitamin D. And it comes in these rather nice, big, easy-to-swallow capsules. I bought that in, was it Spain or Portugal? Anyway, you can't buy it over-the-counter in England. But talk to your nice doctor, and I'm sure he might prescribe you some. As with ivermectin, doctors can prescribe this if they would like to do so. Now, I thought about telling you all sorts about the pharmacodynamics of ivermectin, the way it clogs up the spike protein. No question, of course, in my mind at all that it's highly effective against COVID. Interesting question is, to what degree is it effective against other viral infections? That's an open question and one I'm not going to deal with on this video, but interesting question. I suspect it does have some antiviral effect. But what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read you a few clips. I've just dug out this book again that I've got a couple of years ago from Dr. Pierre Corey, who we've had the privilege of interviewing a couple of times on this channel, famous for his deputation to Senate, of course, about first one was about steroids, then about ivermectin. And I'm just going to read you a couple of clips from this, just sort of, it just sort of sums it up, really. So this is about Dr. Paul Merrick. So Pierre Corey talking about Paul Merrick. Paul was about to identify ivermectin, the inexpensive, incredibly safe, generic repurposed drug as a immensely effective and potent therapy against SARS coronavirus 2. It was discovered that it should have saved lives and ended the pandemic. It could have done that, he's saying. If not for one major problem, repurposed drugs like ivermectin are generally off-patent, which means the manufacturers have lost the exclusive marketing rights. So, in other words, competitors can sell a dirt-cheap version. So not only is repurposing of little interest to the original manufacturer, but any other big pharma companies trying to develop or promote pricey alternatives. So that's from this book by Pierre Corey. I'm just going to read you another little bit as well. It really does sum up a lot of things. Again, this is Pierre Corey, Dr. Corey, eminent respiratory physician, of course, intensive care doctor. It's no longer a debatable fact, Dr. Corey writes, that treating COVID with ivermectin leads to highly statistically significant improvements in time to viral clearance, time to clinical recovery, hospitalizations, and death. And yet, the medicine is not part of any official COVID protocol in the advanced health economies of the world. And if you ask people on the street what they know about ivermectin, I'm betting at least 6 out of 10 would use the words horse dewormer in their reply.
Yes, well, what's worrying is it's the word that GPs use to describe ivermectin too. I think we're living in an age where we need to take more and more responsibility over our own health, and it's annoying because we'd like to be able to trust the doctor. I mean, I grew up in a country where everyone pretty much trusted everyone else, but we're moving into the zero trust economy where the pharmaceutical industry, it seems, and the shareholders, Martin, are more important than us getting better.
Well, that's right. But of course, you know, there's plenty of other things going on during COVID apart from the pharmaceutical industry profiteering. That was definitely happening, but it wasn't the only thing that was going on.
I think it was, in a way, the most obvious example of accelerationism I've ever seen, where you've got a virus spreading around, killing people. Obviously, it's a lot worse. It was quite a bit worse than your average year of flu. People were dropping dead with this thing. and it was weaponized with extra little bits put into the DNA by somebody somewhere, maybe at Fort Detrick, maybe at Wuhan, maybe even possibly here at our very own Porton Down, just outside Salisbury, where I used to work, the BBC there. And in fact, I did a piece on the something called the Common Cold Research Centre, because the British at Porton Down had always been obsessed with the common cold. They wanted to know all about it. And I'm after the whole business of COVID, thinking, well, the coronavirus is a common cold virus, and maybe they were thinking, Martin, that we can take a very contagious virus like the cold and weaponize it.
I think that's exactly what happened, and that's what Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian Chemical and Biological Warfare Troops, General Kirillov, is also a scientist, who was assassinated by the Ukrainians with the support of the British. But of course, they had uncovered that COVID was being experimented on inside the Ukrainian biolabs, which they've also got, the Americans also have biolabs in Georgia and other places. Tulyana Gatasheva from Bulgaria has done an awful lot of useful stuff on all of this. And, you know, it was a deliberately, and of course, that various warnings were given to the Israeli Defense Forces that there was going to be a pandemic coming from China. Now, if it's an accidental leak, you wouldn't know in advance.
It's funny, the Israelis knew all about 9/11 before that happened,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, indeed,
they?
That's right.
How
so, in
do
other words,
they do it?
I don't know how they do it. They've just got such a brilliant intelligence service, Tony, that they know what's going to happen before it even happens.
Yeah, because they're
amazing.
Doing it, maybe. Anyway, there's a chap called Rainer Fulmich in Germany who's been arrested. He's a lawyer who's been doing his best to use the legal system to get to the people behind some of the terrible decisions made during COVID, which have led to the deaths of many, many people. For example, just saying, yes, we can use a jab, which isn't being properly tested at all. We'll just fast track it and stick it into people. This is a really, really bad idea, especially when you've got something hanging around like ivermectin, which isn't going to make much profits for pharma, which may have been better employed. Anyway, let's have a listen to, this is a guy called Cardinal Vigano. He's a Roman Catholic cardinal. I think he's actually part of the Vatican, but he seems to be quite a good chap. Here he is talking about how bad it is that this guy Rainer Fulmich has been put in prison, even though what he's trying to do is just hold these German, in particularly in Germany, hold people to account who made bad decisions in government during COVID.
A dangerous subversive elite has managed to infiltrate the highest levels of Western institutions and governments to implement the criminal plan of the Agenda 2030. In many self-proclaimed democratic states, the voices denouncing this global coup are being silenced through censorship, intimidation, psychiatrization, and even arrest. Among the victims of the totalitarian regime quietly establishing itself in Europe, Canada, Australia, and other vassal nations of the United Nations, NATO, World Health Organization, and World Economic Forum, all private entity funded by the same powers, is lawyer Rainer Fulmich, unjustly in prison and still awaiting for a fair trial. His crime is having dared to speak the truth in a world of criminal lies. I call on Catholics and all people of goodwill to raise their voices in defense of those persecuted by the globalist regime. It is not Attorney Fulmich who should be in prison, but those who committed the greatest crime ever against humanity. Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Klaus Schwab, George Soros, Ursula von der Leyen, Albert Bourla, and all their accomplices and emissaries, especially those in institutional positions. Free Rainer Fulmich.
Thank you, Cardinal. It's worth mentioning Patrick Vallance, who was, obviously, Chief Medical Officer or Deputy Chief Medical Officer during COVID, has now taken on a new role in the House of Lords, cheerleading through the digital ID thing, which is a bit worrying. We'll hear about that in a minute. But Martin, talking about accelerationism, I know Whitney Webb, who we cover a fair bit on here,
She has been writing about, I mean, for many years she's been writing about the mafia in the United States and how it's becoming interchangeable with government over there. But what about Whitney and what she has to say about accelerationism?
Well, the thing I sent you, which we were talking about, it's actually, it's on her website, but it's not written by her. It's written by one of her colleagues. Okay. So it's about accelerationism. And, you know, in that article, which I have read, but I can't remember all of it just off the top of my head. It's quite a long article.
I think it's City States Without Limits.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's written by
Ian Davis.
That's right.
Yeah. He's someone who I've interviewed before. But he's saying, talking about new city states, some being constructed from scratch and others being seeded into existing cities, go by many names. In the United States, Trump has called them freedom cities. The United Nations refers to them as human settlements. The C40 Cities Network, which Sadiq Khan chairs in London, or from London, calls them 15-minute cities. The Global Parliament of Mayors refers to them as resilient cities, and the Charter Cities Institute calls them, unsurprisingly, charter cities. Whatever they're called, he says, they have a defined set of common characteristics. Emerging city-states are centrally planned, designed to maximise the use of technology, already close to becoming completed smart cities. They've been given independent jurisdiction with varying degrees of autonomy from the nation states in which they reside. It's an interesting article, isn't it? But how does he relate it to accelerationism?
Well, because it's the sort of thing that people like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk are into. They don't really believe in the nation state as such, although they're quite happy to take the government's money from the Pentagon to do everything they're doing. The idea is that we're going to create a libertarian paradise with everybody on with digital ID. I mean, you'd have to read the article to get the full gist of it. But of course, these billionaires that are calling the shots now have in fact got very dystopian visions of the future. Not that they're necessarily achievable, but that's what they want to do.
So I don't know about them calling the shots. I tend to think that it's actually Nazi Nick from Langley Park School when I was 14 that seems to be calling many of the shots. Anyway, he wrote a piece, I think it was around about 2017, called A Quick and Dirty Introduction to Accelerationism, which is quite pithy and explains what he's doing. And I was particularly pleased to see a massive anti-fascist demonstration outside a gallery in London a few years ago where Nick came over to speak, because at least the Londoners have figured out actually what his philosophy is. And Nick says in this quick and dirty introduction, he says, anyone trying to work out what they think about accelerationism better do so quickly. That's the nature of the thing. It's already caught up with trends that seem too fast to track when it began to become self-aware decades ago. It's picked up a lot of speed since then. Accelerationism is old enough to have arrived in waves, which is to say insistently, recurrently, each time the challenge is more urgent. Among the predictions is the expectation you'll be too slow to deal with it coherently. Yet if you fumble the question it poses, because rushed you lose, perhaps very badly, it's hard. For our purposes, you are standing in as a bearer of the opinion of mankind. He says, time pressure by its very nature is difficult to think about. Typically, while the opportunity for deliberation is not presumed, it is at least, with overwhelming likelihood, mistaken for an historical constant rather than variable. If there was ever time to think, we think there still is and always will be. The definite probability that allotment of time to decision-making is undergoing systematic compression remains a neglected consideration, even those amongst paying explicit and exceptional attention to the increasing rapidity of change. In it goes on and on. It's actually quite an interesting piece. But what he's saying basically is that you've lost. We've already decided what we're going to do, and we're going to do it far too quickly for you to actually be able to have a say in it.
Well, that's right. And of course, his real audience are the people who fund him, who are the billionaires. He's regarded as the brain behind it all because he's an academic. But in actual fact, he's articulating the ideas that the billionaires and the cloud feudalists want to see happen. And of course, he's got this idea that machines and transhumanism are taking over whether we like it or not. And it's probably just best to join them rather than try and beat them. And but in any case, they'll have already gone faster than we were.
He also talks quite interestingly about where is the revolutionary path. He says there's not going to be any space for it. Accelerate the process, recommended Deleuze and Guattari in their 1972 Anti-Oedipus, citing Nietzsche to reactivate Marx. Although it would take another four decades before accelerationism was named as such by Benjamin Noyes, it was already there in its entirety. The relevant passage is worth repeating in full, as it would be repeatedly. Well, I'm not going to actually repeat it, but he's quoting these various philosophers. The point of analysis of capitalism or nihilism is to do more of it. The process is not to be critiqued. The process is the critique feeding back into itself as it escalates. The only way forward is through, which means further in. So he's saying basically that we're just being sucked into this whether we like it or not.
Well, if you read Karl Marx, written in the 19th century, he points out, I can't remember which particular text it was, all that is solid melts into air. You know, in other words, capitalism is that system which constantly revolutionizes social relations. And of course, in the 19th century, people were stunned by how quickly things changed. Yeah. And it was a big change, you know, from largely rural society, railways, factories, you know, all of these things, steamships, telegraph. And of course, all that's happened since then is it's just got faster and faster, but the same forces are still very much at work.
I mean, surely there is. Nick's wrong when he says that there is no revolution with this, because it's all just going to. There must be. Surely there is.
Well, it depends what you mean by
revolution.
Isn't
this wishful thing? He's saying that you cannot overthrow this, that everything that you might be thinking about doing, they've already thought of it and blocked you from doing it.
Well, it's what Karl Rove said years ago, isn't it? You know, you live in the reality-based community, and we are just going to create reality now, and then, you'll just have to adapt. And that was just after 9/11, and they were just going to take over the world, and, you know, that was their attitude. But, of course, that's ground to a halt, because there's a different model evolving in China and Russia and the developing world, and it's not going according to plan for the billionaires. They're not winning a lot of things. In actual fact, it's turned out to be a struggle as always. And, you know, they're not necessarily going to have it all their own way.
No, well, I like to think that. So where is the revolution? Come on, Martin. You love your revolutions. Where
is it? The obvious one to point out, which is quite a peaceful revolution, is the Communist Party of China have worked out how to manage capitalism and the West doesn't know how to deal with it.
No. You see, I think Nick would say, look, no, the Chinese are just doing exactly what we want. They want a mass surveillance society.
They've always had one. Even Imperial China was quite organised. You know, people didn't get, you know, that's been their tradition all along. The problem for the West is that they're not doing it the way they want them to do it. They've got a different perspective. And in actual fact, they're taking the markets of the accelerationists because they understand all the things Nick understands, but they're bending it to their own purposes.
Well, I do wonder why he's over there, because he sees China as a threat, or because he just sees China as the natural place to sit to surf these changes. Anyway, there's also another story this week. The Electronic Intifada reports an absconded activist refuses to be a prisoner of war. This is earlier this week. Palestine Action activist Sean Middleborough, 33, nicknamed Shibby, has absconded from a UK prison after being released on temporary bail for his brother's wedding. In a statement exclusive to the Electronic Intifada, he said he was not a terrorist and should never have been imprisoned in the first place. After a four-day conditional release on 23rd of October, he did not return to Wandsworth Prison in London. Despite regular police checks at his home address, he managed to slip away without his family's knowledge, sources confirmed to the Electronic Intifada. He's from Liverpool, and he was on remand for a third time in connection with an August 2024 action at an Elbit weapons factory in Filton, a town near Bristol in southwest England. Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest arms manufacturer, and a British subsidiary, Elbit Systems, operates 16 sites across the country. During the Filton action, protesters allegedly drove a van into the factory and damaged Israeli weapons developed there. Middleborough is accused of causing over $2.5 million in damages. It resulted in, amongst other things, the destruction of armed quadcopters widely used by the Israeli military in its genocidal aggression on Gaza. Six people were arrested on the spot, detained for 36 hours without legal representation or able to contact family or the outside world, and charged with criminal damage, aggravated burglary, violent disorder. Further arrests by British counter-terrorism police over the next year saw a total of 24 people detained in connection with the Filton action, including Middleborough. He's still in prison. He hasn't even had a trial yet. He's saying, I'm not a terrorist, so I'm going to walk out of jail, and it's, which is exactly what he's done.
Well, yes. I mean, I did read about this earlier in the week. The 23 of them are still in there, and several of them are on hunger strike now, I understand, because of the conditions of being, in which they're being held. And, of course, for criminal damage, which is what they're actually being charged with, they should have even been taken to court already, or they should have been released on remand. But they're keeping them in prison because they know that if they can get to a jury trial, they might even get off.
You see,
so they're making the punishment, you know, by keeping them in prison.
This is in form of internment. This is the sort of thing that was used during the Northern Ireland Troubles and by the apartheid white supremacists in South Africa.
Well, that's right. It's an abuse of legal
by the
process.
Israelis, of course, as well. So this is an Israeli problem. Tactic, basically. Anyway, yes. He's decided no, and he's wandered out. So I thought it'd be interesting to... And it turns out that he's been doing these podcasts. He's based in Liverpool. So I thought it'd be interesting to have a listen to some of the things. They had a look at some book. I'm trying to think what is actually the name of the book. It's called Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher. Have you ever come across that, Martin?
Nope.
But anyway, he's going to talk now on his podcast about that. So let's get to know Sean Middleborough a little bit.
Infamous, very famous, Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher, the one and only. So here's how this is basically going to work. We've already read some chapters. I've written some notes down. And I'm just going to go through it. We're just going to flow, throw the ideas back and forward, essentially see what it takes us. So capitalist realism is the idea that our imaginations have been so heavily constricted by capitalism that we cannot even conceive of any other functioning system. Okay, so let's hop right into this. Chapter 1. It's called, It's Easier to Imagine the End of the World Than the End of Capitalism. So the first thing here that Fisher talks about is the film Children of Men. I don't know if you've seen it. It's very helpful if you have for this. And it essentially talks about how dystopian the film is and how it perfectly encapsulates the term capitalist realism. That not only is capitalism the only viable political and economic system, but also how it is impossible even to imagine a coherent alternative to it. And how the film demonstrates capitalist realism taken to its logical conclusion, its most severe, its endpoint, essentially. Within the film, there is a government that has been stripped of basically all function except military or police function. There are internment camps, etc. And how the state essentially functions as a handmaiden to the economic system. And this is something that I've always said and always talked about, how the political system exists to protect the economic system. Okay, which means that the economic system is primary in any society, and the politicians simply exist to determine what happens with the economy, whether you get sort of, you know, full-blown 100% neoliberalism, as you get in, you know, conservative or Republican governments, or just that, but with a smiley face in the Democratic or Labour equivalent.
The economic system being, of course, capitalism, yeah.
Right, yeah, definitely. But even if it wasn't capitalism, right? Like, even if we had a communist society, the political system in that society would exist to defend the economic system. You would have, well, depending on what form of communism you had, right? Because some people believe in one-party rule, but the economic system there is to protect the political system there is to protect the economic system, right? The economic system is primary, and everything is downwind of the economic system, essentially. Let's have a little look here. And he then compares this to the role that the state played in the 2008 economic crash, about basically how the state came in during that time to save capitalism from the inevitable disaster it got itself in. So in the film Children of Men, the book talks about how there's no singular moment of disaster, right? There's no black swan event that wakes everyone up and makes them understand that we've passed the point of no return. Instead, society is incredibly elastic. It just keeps stretching further and further, and disaster just keeps stretching and stretching. And there's no grand moment of understanding. There's no point at which everyone wakes up and understands. Essentially, what you get instead is a perpetual sleepwalking into disaster. And it's evident within the theme of Children of Men, that sterility should be read metaphorically, Fisher writes, as the displacement of another kind of anxiety. And this anxiety cries out to be read in cultural terms. And the question the film poses is, how long can a culture persist without the new? What happens if the young are no longer capable of producing surprises or capable of imagining anything new? And this is one of the impacts of capitalist realism, obviously, that Fisher spoke about earlier, right? The inability to imagine any other alternative. The power of capitalist realism derives in part from the way that capitalism subsumes and consumes all of previous history, right? So one effect of its system of equivalence, which can assign all cultural objects, whether they are religious iconography, pornography, or Das Kapital, it can assign all of them a monetary value, right? Capital is obviously king within capitalism. And if you walk around the British Museum, where you see objects torn from their life worlds and assembled as if on the deck of some predator spaceship, right? You have a powerful image of this process at work. In the conversion of practices and rituals into merely aesthetic objects, the beliefs of previous cultures are objectively ionized. They are transformed into living, breathing things as part of a real history and culture, into nothing but artifacts.
They're taken in as capitalist artifacts and admired in these senses and as living and breathing artifacts of capitalist society because people have went there and physically stolen. It's about power. It's about going over there and conquering culture. Anything that another civilization has produced is stolen.
So that's Sean in Middleborough, who's absconded this week. Martin, I mean, it's interesting that, he's the Scouser. So he's running his own podcast and he's talking about all sorts of interesting things, basically a similar thing to what we were just discussing about accelerationism there, this whole concept that capitalism just buys up history, basically. It buys up everything. Once the governments are, and the democratic institutions and the elite institutions are infested, then they can do what they want. They just buy up history. I mean, this is very Orwellian, actually, isn't it? This idea that, you know, he who controls the past controls the future and all that.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said earlier, Marx said, in the 19th century, all that is solid melts into air. So capitalism is in itself a revolutionary system because it gets rid of what was there previously and inserts itself in every interstice in the society. But I have to put a caveat on this, that when you say that the economic system determines the social system and the political system, that is the traditional Marxist view. You know, ultimately, the economy determines things. That's the base. And then everything else, like culture, politics, is the superstructure. But, of course, in reality, it's a bit more complicated because the superstructure can affect the base. Mm. Yeah.
So what they're saying there is it's the other way around, that actually the financial system will allow certain kinds of political systems to emerge at certain times. But actually, if it can bankrupt a government, for example, that government's gone.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, I think it's a more fundamental critique than that, isn't it?
But interesting that this guy is this is what he's doing on his podcast. It sounds to me as if some of these Palestine Action people are very, very smart, and they're looking at philosophy, they're looking at critiquing modern society, and that's probably why he's decided to abscond.
Well, and also to do the thing in the first place and to take a stand. I mean, I've got nothing but admiration for these mostly young people who've done this. And I would hope that, you know, universities being the prisons, prisons being the universities of the revolution, that some of these people in the future
well,
are going
actually,
to be one of our,
know,
some of
you
our
know
leaders.
What you just said is a great Freudian statement. The universities can be prisons, can't they?
Well, they can, yes.
I but remember getting
prisons,
Oxford,
prisons of the universities
Oxford,
of the revolution.
I used to use the library in Oxford. I used to walk through the Bodleian. And you'd see all these people there, and you think, oh, shouldn't they be enjoying themselves? They're looking down at some book, and they look really depressed and like, well, it was just, I thought coming to Oxford was going to be fun, but this is really, really boring. And there was tens, hundreds of them all there in the library, reading away and just basically
filling their heads with things they were told to fill their heads with. And not, I mean, I felt much happier because I was in there looking for the stuff that I wanted to look for, and digging it out and reading it and sometimes scanning it in and putting it on the internet, as I did with the old Bilderberg.org website. But, I mean, university can be a prison, can't it? Especially when it becomes commercialised. That's that Mario Savio speech.
Yeah. Well, there's a Turkish film called Yol, The Way, which came out in the early 1980s. And it, basically the plot is that this guy gets released from prison. He's a political prisoner. He finally gets released from prison in Turkey. And it becomes clear that the whole society is a prison. That in actual fact, that's the main trope of the film. And in the end, he tries to escape with his wife over the mountains out of Turkey. But, if can, you know, modern society in some ways is a great big prison, isn't it? For everybody, whether you're inside or outside.
Yep, certainly is. It can be a prison planet. That's where the Alex Jones thing turned up back in the 1990s or around about 2000. I remember thinking, God, this is slick. This is very slick. And of course, it's still going today. Anyway, whilst we're still talking about Palestine Action, former Palestine Action activist, now Palestine Solidarity Campaign flag waver on the bridges of motorways, Nick Georges, got assaulted about 3 weeks ago by some guy who he described as a Tommy Robinson type person, and he, not only was he assaulted, he was knocked unconscious and had a hairline skull fracture. So there's been an appeal put out for somebody. The police still haven't named him, which is extraordinary. The person who's supposed to be responsible for this, GBH, the police are saying that they're looking for him, but they haven't put any appeal out. Extraordinarily, Martin, the local Palestine Solidarity Group have had to put their own appeal out with photographs of this guy. And says, anyone know who he is, please call Crime Stoppers, and putting these posters up on social media and around Egham in Surrey, where the assault took place. Now, this I find, I mean, police will say, oh, well, we're very busy, it's lots of cuts, but this is appalling, isn't it, that the campaigners themselves have got to put an appeal out for witnesses to GBH and the police aren't doing it?
Yes, and he's quite an elderly chap as well, wasn't he? You know, so we're talking about people who could easily be seriously injured by such an attack.
Yeah, could have been killed. So anyway, let's have a listen now to an update on the Egham attack on Nick Georges. And Nick tells me that he's going to be on Crispin Flintoff's programme on Sunday. There's already recorded an interview with Nick about it, which is lovely to see. I mean, I like to think of us as complementing the Crispin Flintoff show. We're doing all sorts of things that are similar to them and to him. And we've had him on this programme as well several times over the over the years. So let's have a listen now to Nick's update for this show.
My name's Nick Georges. Just giving you an update on the attack that happened to me on, I think it's the 15th of November. I can't remember now, but it was about 2 weeks ago now. And so I was interviewed by the police. I went down to the police station to give a statement. And gave my statement, answered all his questions. But they didn't really seem to be very activated about doing anything, I must admit. There was a whole group of people there, two girls who took all the photographs, but they weren't really interested in chasing that up. And apparently they had looked a couple of times for him, but not found him. They know exactly who they're looking for. So came out there feeling a little bit deflated, feeling that there's definitely not a lot of action and effort going into it, and that obviously the police are so busy and their resources are so stretched with arresting all these terrorists who are sitting in Parliament Square holding a piece of cardboard. So what we've done, we've actually managed to get photographs of the attacker from the video that was taken, and we've created a poster now, which we're going to put out on social media all around the Egham area. Very, actually quite reasonably good quality photos of this man who attacked me. We're also working on getting articles in the Woking Mail and the Farnham Herald. I think apparently they're trying to do a joint thing about that. My friend Simon and his wife, they were both attacked in Farnham a few days prior to our attack, and we're trying to get publicity for that as well. And they were quite it was an assault, wasn't a physical assault quite as bad as mine, but an extremely violent, aggressive man ran up to them, swearing and cursing, ripped the phones out of both of their hands, my friend and his wife, 69-year-old pensioner, and hurled their phones to the ground. It was very abusive, and we've got some very good video shots of all that as well. But this is just an example of what is going on at the moment, and I think we've actually logged five other incidents of aggressive assaults and attacks in the last month to us all as we've been protesting.
Well, look, I mean, you could argue, Nick, that these are hate crimes against you as well as violent physical assaults, including GBH. The police have not put out an appeal to the press at all about this story. In fact, they haven't confirmed it to the Farnham newspaper. So they had a headline saying reported attack, because the police wouldn't confirm the attack had even taken place. But what advice have you got for campaigners in the light of this? Because it doesn't sound as if the police are really looking too hard for the people who are violently assaulting pro-Palestine demonstrators.
It's very difficult. What on earth do you do when you're faced by a gang of seven thugs who are determined to attack you, who have been so wound up and indoctrinated and propagandized by presumably Tommy Robinson, who's obviously paid and managed completely by Israel. He drives around in a great big Bentley, obviously supplied by Israel. And he does their bidding, and he's got this huge outreach, and he's massively incentivized all his right-wing followers, who are normally only interested in hating immigrants. He's incentivized them all somehow to hate Palestinian protesters. And this is now a very big threat to us all. One of the things we do when we protest now, we tell everybody the minute there's the first sign of any violence or aggression, drop your banners, drop your flags, get your phones out and video instantly. Don't hang about, don't mess about, get your phones out, as many as you as possible. I mean, if these people see 20 people with their phones out videoing them, that's a huge disincentive to them. The other thing, you know, I think you always need one or two people. If you're protesting, you need one or two people on lookout all the time now, watching. Try not to be too spread out. Try and keep in relatively tight-knit groups. And especially be aware if you're protesting in isolated places where there aren't a lot of public about, although this doesn't seem to put them off in the least bit. You know, if you want to, you can phone the police beforehand, tell them you're doing a peaceful protest, tell them you're worried about being attacked. Whether or not they'll come and protect you, I really don't know. They're not renowned for protecting Palestine protesters in at all. Very often they end up protecting the right-wing thugs. So it's a bit of a difficult question to work out, that one. Just be aware, be sharp, and have those phones on the ready. Get everyone who's on the protest really primed. And it takes a little while to get your phone out, get the code in, get your phone opened up, get it in the video program. Maybe if people practice that. And don't worry about your banners or your placards or your flags. And just drop them on the ground and get those phones out. But seriously.
One thing I would add, Nick, is for the protest groups really to cultivate with good relations, get mobile phone numbers of local journalists. So if things do start to happen, it can even be, if something's going to last a little while, that the journalists can come down and actually, interview people on the spot. So good relations with your local press, I think, is always cultivate it. You know, human beings, yeah. Find a human being, find their phone mobile number, talk to them and explain some of the situations. And also, of course, by having that good relationship, they can be pressurising the police to act. But it's very worrying to hear that the police don't really seem to have got their finger out here. And, of course, it is possible that some violent thugs may have contacts in the police that give them the confidence to go and commit assaults because they think that their friends in the police may protect them in some way. But anyway, what's the best way to find, your stuff, social media or your local Palestine group, Nick?
It's West Surrey PSC, basically. So, yes, if you go online and just put in WSPSC, it's West Surrey PSC.
Okay, Nick Georges, thanks very much for giving us an update again.
That's brilliant. Thank you too, Tony.
And you can see the pictures of the guy that they filmed attacking. You see the pictures of him doing the attacking, but they've done this kind of photo fit of the guy, the local Egham Palestine Solidarity Group, which they're now sharing on social media because the police haven't been doing it. And also, extraordinarily, the police have not released the name of the person. They say they're searching for it. There may potentially be an operational reason for that, but it seems very unlikely and rather doubtful. And so if you go to thisweek.org.uk, you can see the picture of the person. Anyone you know in that part of the country, it'd be nice. It's almost like we're doing the police press's job for them here tonight. Please do share it with them, it may be that someone can identify the individuals that the police are supposed to be looking for, Martin.
Yes, well, it's all good stuff. Can I just mention, because it's on the top of my mind, tomorrow in Bristol, there's another attempt by the so-called Bristol Patriots to intimidate people in the Mercure Hotel who are asylum seekers, and the Bristol Anti-Fascist Coalition will be there to protest against
Thankfully,
it.
Thankfully, the Anti-Fascist Coalition are rather bigger.
Well, that's right. That's what's happening. It's still a nuisance.
Is this a police exercise here?
Well, no. What it is they ought to give up doing this in Bristol, because we've seen them off several times, but they're still doing it. We're assembling at midday tomorrow. Okay, so I'll just let anybody who's listening live to plug them into that.
So is this is a regular occurrence now?
Well, it's becoming a regular occurrence as a result of all the fuss that's been made.
Who do you think is behind these? Because obviously the idea of intimidating the asylum, people in the asylum places, seems to be pointless. The people, they're not behind this. Okay, so they're the public face of this, but the many people behind the mass migration, they're in smoke-filled rooms in Brussels and London, in Westminster.
Well, I mean, the point is that the people in the asylum seekers in that hotel are there because they're desperately being told to go. I feel as if you think it's okay to come to the hotel and intimidate them, is it okay for us to come around to your house where you live? And don't forget, we will be taking photographs of you. And if you live in Bristol, we may find where you live. And then maybe you need police protection in your house. Because if you're going to come to somebody else's house, maybe somebody's going to come to your house. As I said to one of them at the last protest you had, you need to go to Belfast and Bosnia and have a think what Bristol could be like. One of the things I would also say about these people is they were waving Israeli flags. So that's nothing to do with people in boats at all, is it? It's just support for genocide.
As I said, we're going to look at the role of Lord Valence, Patrick Valence. But before we hear from him, this is in the bringing about this Tony Blair ID card scheme. There's actually quite a lot of resistance to it. And I will put on our show page at thisweek.org.uk a long version of this debate in the House of Lords, because there hasn't been any proper debate, as far as I know, in the House of Commons about it. But the House of Lords, almost as soon as it was announced by Starmer on TV rather than on the House of Commons with a one-page press release, there was actually a pretty good debate in. And I found this on the website. I think it's called Liar Politicians. Now, in the early days of YouTube, this was a brilliant channel. So I would suggest, right, this is my educated guesswork, it's someone that used to work in TV and knows a good little bit of debate and a clip when they see one. So they're, I think, putting bits and pieces up on this. But you just never find the Liar Politician things on YouTube anymore. The algorithms have made sure, just as with my YouTube channel, they're very difficult to find. So they get probably 100 times less hits than they used to do. That's the beauty or evil of these algorithms. So before we hear from Patrick Valence, he of COVID fame, before we hear from him, we're going to hear from someone called Viscount Camrose, who put the case against ID cards in the House of Lords.
My Lords, we unequivocally oppose the government's dangerous, mandatory digital ID policy, both in principle and in practice. If allowed to become legislation, the electorate risks being subject to an extraordinary expansion of state power, one that comes not only at the expense of personal freedom, but at great cost to the taxpayer. Before I outline our objections to this proposal, it is important first to understand the wider context in which this policy has been announced. Over the year in government, an estimated 50,000 people have entered the country on small boats, the largest recorded number to date. But the Secretary of State has claimed digital IDs will deter these illegal migrants. My Lords, where is the evidence for this claim? Criminal gangs and illegal workers already operate outside formal employment and taxation systems. They don't care about paperwork or credentials. They work illegally beyond the reach of existing regulation. They subvert existing national insurance requirements. So why would we expect digital ID to be different? To suggest that a digital ID would somehow deter these operations is untested, it is unfounded, it is too optimistic to be convincing. We're concerned, too, about the vast scope of this programme. The government has also claimed that digital IDs will result in, and I quote, more joined-up public services, saving people time from having to restate personal details to multiple departments. Here the government seems to me to conflate separate issues, more effective public services and curbing illegal migration. They promise an end to bureaucracy while simultaneously constructing one of the most intrusive systems of state surveillance in our nation's history. This is vast in its objectives, slight in its detail, and frankly, creepy in its reach into our privacy. Better online services do not require a centralized identity regime. We already have mechanisms such as right to work checks and DBS verification. These have all been designed with consent and privacy in mind, with nobody forced to pursue the digital route. The government's policy would herald an end to that freedom. My Lords, this policy was not even in the government's manifesto. There is no democratic mandate for digital ID, nor is there any appetite for it. In fact, over 2.8 million people have already signed a petition opposing it.
So that's part of a much longer up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it's a nearly an hour long discussion and debate. Most of the people weighing in the House of Lords are saying this is going to be a disastrous idea. It's a recipe for mass surveillance. What do you think, Martin?
Well, I'm opposed to it, as most many people are, and I think it's very unwise of Keir Starmer to push it forward, because it's quite likely he's not going to get what he wants, because the opposition to it is cross-party, it's across the political spectrum. Jeremy Corbyn's opposed to it, Nigel Farage is opposed to it. Who does he think is going to support it? An opinion poll suggests that people don't want it.
Well, maybe he'll just try and force it through and bully all his MPs into supporting it and say, well, we're going to suspend you from the party unless you agree to this, that sort of thing. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the other side of the debate. That's Patrick Vallance. He of COVID jab supremo fame. And so he's now Mr. I mean, I think maybe we should, after this clip, we'll have a little think and a look about Blair's involvement in this scheme.
I will start by addressing the concerns that have been raised by both Viscount Camrose and Lord Clement Jones. In the context of the Data Use and Access Act, we were clear that the services under that legislation were not mandatory, nor were they ever designed to be, and they cover many of the areas that have been discussed so far. This new national digital ID will be required for, and specifically for, and only for, right-to-work checks by the end of this Parliament. It is a very narrow use for a very specific purpose. But we have always believed, and continue to believe, that there are huge upsides for a digitally enabled society, one where everyone feels able to participate, everyone feels a sense of agency, and everyone's lives are made easier by a digital key that does indeed unlock access to services, something that is a big upside to a digitally enabled society. And those businesses that enable this, and we've seen this in other countries that have introduced a digital ID, and the services that those businesses provide will have an important role to play. We expect the digital identity market to be able to build on the national digital pass and offer value-add services for individuals and businesses. In countries where digital ID is well established, the private sector has built a wide range of services around it, making everyday tasks like open banking, renting a flat, applying for a mortgage, all faster, simpler and more secure. But that is not a mandatory use of this. The required use is for right to work. Let me turn to the subject of illegal migration, a problem that obviously has grown enormously over the past 10 to 15 years. I would absolutely agree that there is no silver bullet to solving illegal migration, but ensuring that there is a single digital system to prove that you have a right to work will simplify the process and drive up compliance, making it easier for businesses and providing the Home Office, and I think this is an important point, with an overview of employers conducting checks they can use to audit those suspected of hiring illegally. It will be possible for them to see where there are a large number of employees but only two or three that have been checked for work. Ultimately, this should be easier for honest, legitimate employers to get started and harder, much harder, for those employing illegally.
Yeah, but what if they don't tell you anything about how many they're employing and they just get on with it and make money and pay them in cash? So anyway, that's Patrick Vallance there, giving the other side, and he's also in the longer version, which I'll put up later on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Yeah, the obvious point I would make is that the people coming across on small boats that everybody's getting excited about, they cannot work because they're claiming asylum.
Well, they sometimes do.
No, they're not allowed to.
They sometimes
do. In some other countries in Europe, they are allowed to work while they're...
No, no, but they do sometimes work. They sometimes just go off and get jobs and work. But a lot of people, for example, are people who come over on tourist visas, like lots of Brazilian drivers that... I don't know what...
Yes, so we're talking about different kinds of illegal migration.
Of course we are. Yeah.
So the people in the boats are coming here to claim asylum, and that's the only reason that they come here, to claim asylum. The rules are, if they're claiming asylum, they cannot work, which is why they're in the hotels, which is why it's costing so much money.
Correct.
The people who come here on tourist visas and overstay, or students who overstay, well, that's another issue. Yeah, but of course everything gets pushed into a great big mulch.
It's really nothing to do. Nothing to do. You know, nothing to do with the foreigners, is it? Really, it doesn't seem to me to be anything to do with
no. I mean, the digital ID thing, you want to push it through anyway. I mean, that's the point I'm making.
They managed to get the ID through for being able to vote as well, didn't they? And so all of these things are saying, I know it's so difficult. It's so difficult because you have your ID for this, that, and everything else. Your driving license, blah blah blah. Your passport. Wouldn't it be nice to just have one little digital thing? And you can do it all much more easily, and we can keep an eye on you everywhere you go and everything
that's
you do.
That's right. So in other words, they're using this as an excuse to bring in digital ID, because in actual fact, as pointed out by the first contributor, the people who are coming in and overstaying and then doing work on the side, they're not going to be affected by it anyway, because that everything is done,
cash.
It's all done in the black economy.
So
in
just another thing to say about this is, I've been looking into and dealing with the whole issue of travellers in Bristol, that is to say new age travellers or van dwellers and Irish travellers as well in the city, because the council seem to be closing every single site where people have been staying traditionally, trying to get everyone to pay council tax. And I had a chat with a woman called Georgie from Bristol City Council, who's what they call a traveller liaison person, and she let it slip to me. She said, oh, well, we want to get them into these compounds where they have to pay to be in there, because then, Martin, we know who they are. They don't like the idea that someone might be out there who they don't know what their name is, and they haven't got an ID on them.
Well, I suppose the positive side of that, if you to spin it, is that they could then register to vote and all the rest of it. But, you know, the issues behind it are up the fundamental issues to do with housing.
People who can register to vote and do register to vote, but then they've decided there's no point.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, this why people are living in vans is because they can't afford the rent. And that's a massive problem all over the world, and particularly here in Bristol.
Back to this idea of trying to ID and track everybody. Where did it all come from, Mr. Blair?
I'm just going to connect the dots for you. Tony Blair wants digital ID for all of us, and he said that we need a digital system that the governments can know who've been vaccinated and who hasn't. But who funds his institute? Because it isn't the public, it's Larry Ellison. Larry Ellison, the billionaire co-founder of Oracle, who gave the Tony Blair Institute tens of millions, who also happens to be the single biggest private donor to the Israeli Defence Forces. Surprise, surprise, look who's buying TikTok. Oracle, led by Larry Ellison. Him, along with other pro-Israel billionaires, are planning to spend $14 billion to take over the app. Oracle will take 15% and run the algorithm, so that means they decide what shows up in your feed. So to spell it out, the guy that's bankrolling Blair's digital ID push is the single biggest donor to the IDF and is now linked to a plan where Blair could run the post-war in Gaza and is buying the app where millions of people get their news on Palestine. The same people are lining up to control your health data, your social media feed, and even territory. It's funny to me how it's always the same people, but surely this spells it out enough for you. But it probably won't, so I'll just pop my tinfoil hat back on.
I think we had actually used that clip a few weeks ago, but it's making a very good point about Larry Ellison, Martin.
Yes, and of course, Oracle were the people that messed up the computers at Birmingham City Council and pushed it into potential bankruptcy. So, I mean, these people are very, very Zionist, very, very wealthy, and, you know, they're basically trying to take over. There's no doubt about it.
Now, on Sunday, it seems, I mean, I don't remember this as a youngster, but they seem to have two Remembrance Sundays now. It's not a Remembrance Sunday, it's also on the 11th of November. Everyone, there was all sorts of effort put in to get as many people as possible down to the cenotaph. But there are discussions around, aren't there, about whether this is appropriate anymore, because, yes, you could see this as a celebrating the destruction of fascism in the Second World War. But nowadays, sort of celebrating the idea of Britain's invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq isn't quite the same, is it?
No, it isn't. But, I mean, you know, Remembrance Sunday has always been a bit, you know, problematic. I know, for example, relatives of mine, which I've never met, but my dad was telling me about, he fought in the First World War. He refused. He didn't take any of his medals, and he refused to go to any such commemorations because he just said that, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. We should be, you know, this is actually setting everything up for the next war.
Well, my granddad Charlie, I know he refused to fight, and he decided he was going to go and work for the Red Cross or as an ambulance driver. And in effect, in a way, through the First World War, I mean, he had this kind of, I suppose you could call it a thousand-yard stare. You know, he'd seen things that no one really should ever see, Martin, in the First World War, the death and destruction. What was it all for?
Well, you know, you can ask me, and I'm going, well, I don't know. But I think the point is that was...
It was the Cousins' War, wasn't this it? It was Tsar Nicholas, it was Kaiser Wilhelm, and George V, and they were all cousins, and it was basically like a family squabble.
Yes, well, I mean, it's like the joke from Blackadder, isn't it? You know, there was an ostrich, and it was assassinated, and that's why we ended up in the war. What's not Blackadder? What's it?
Anyway, let's just have a listen to a report from... Well, you can work that one out while we're listening to the report from... I think this is possibly Sky News or... on Remembrance Sunday this year.
Underneath the cenotaph, King Charles led the nation in memory of those who left the battle but never returned. World War II was both tragedy and triumph. Back then, Mervyn Kirsch, Jim Grant and Henry Rice were young soldiers. Today they represent the friends denied the chance to grow old with them. With each year, the line between the past and present gets longer and memory thinner.
The ultimate sacrifice, it was given by the fallen. And that's why we have to remember that. And we just have to keep remembering year on year on year.
The further back in history you go, the less we remember. But look around you today. Are you telling me this is a country that is forgetting its fallen heroes?
Over 100 million people died in World Wars 1 and 2. Today, the Prime Minister and the opposition stood shoulder to shoulder in a procession, paying their respects.
So 100 million deaths, but how many British? I mean, actually, it was Chinese and Russia, I think, were the highest numbers.
In the Second World War, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, what do you make of this annual get together? In I mean, they all march off, don't they? All of the military people and all of the ex prime ministers march off into the Foreign Office at the end of it all. And I wonder, is any of them not a Freemason?
Well, I don't know, Tony.
But anyway, where do they? What do they? They go for lunch in the Foreign Office there together. I look at them and I think, what are they cooking up next? What do you think they may be cooking up next?
Well, my uncle, which I never met, when I was talked to him about by my father, he refused to go to any of these things, as many servicemen did. And he said to my dad, because he fought in the First World War, he's a fighter, he's an artilleryman, because my dad was a teenager after the Second World War. He was a kid in the Second World War. And he said to his mother, my grandmother, you know, look at all these kids, they're all going to be doing it again. In 20 years' time, it'll all be happening again. So he was he refused to take any of his medals, because he was, you know, he was given various medals, he refused to take them. And my dad was saying to me that at that time, that was a very unusual position. You know, most people were still bought into the whole thing in a way that subsequently there was a lot more questions asked about.
But the thing is that the First World War, they said this is the war to end all wars.
That was that was the slogan, the
and
war to end
now
wars.
A generation later, it's almost as if the same
two generations
of,
later.
All right, well, yeah, okay, but it's I'm trying to say here, maybe that wasn't the right expression, but as the last people who can remember the Second World War are dying. The whole thing, it seems to be, is being recycled. The idea is that no one will know what's going on because the people that were there the last time are dead.
Well, that's right. And I think it's become part of, I mean, the whole thing of having Remembrance Sunday and the Cenotaph and the Red Poppies and the creation of the Royal British Legion was, I mean, as you know, Tony, the Royal British Legion, as one of its articles of association, they will campaign for the abolition of war.
Well, they used to. I think that's gone now.
Yes, I
mean,
I know,
this was about 8-9 years ago. The British Legion changed enormously, became a sort of corporate thing.
Yeah.
And many of the people that had been running it were ousted.
Yes, but I mean, when the Remembrance Sunday was first instituted in the 1920s, it was in fact due to public pressure that something, you know, we ought to remember those who died and also the sacrifice that was made so that we might have a peaceful future.
Well, no, we might have no future.
Well, that's the danger we've got now,
anyway,
isn't it?
Somebody piped up this year about this, on exactly what you're talking about. His name's Alex Penstone. He was a World War II veteran, so let's see what he had to say.
I can see in my mind's eye there were rows and rows of white stones of all the hundreds of my friends and everybody else that gave their lives for what? The country of today. No, I'm sorry. The sacrifice wasn't worth the result that it is now.
What do you mean by that, though, at this point?
What we fought for, and what we fought for was our freedom. We find that even now it's downside worse than what it was when I fought for it.
So he's saying basically there's been a big decline. Now, Talk TV and the Murdoch Empire tried to spin that in a rather sneaky, nasty way as he's against the migrants, against the Muslims, but then they would. What he's actually saying, and if you listen to what he says there, he's saying that the country's worse off now than it was then, and he fought for freedom.
Well, I mean, what he exactly meant by that, you'd have to ask him, because I don't know any more than you do. But yes, I mean, the fact...
He's saying, but look, okay, I just said it, I'll say it again. The country's worse off now than it was back then.
I think that's an exaggeration. We're not being bombed by the Luftwaffe at the moment, are we?
Shall we say, to begin with, I mean, he's not talking about during the... Martin, he's not talking about during the war, is he? He's talking about whatever it was before the war.
In fact,
if you remember, when I was over during COVID, talking to some people in Stroud at a demonstration there, one of the ladies I was recording, and if you go back to that programme, you can hear it. What she says is, God, this is worse than it was during the war. And actually, yes, it was a tough life in the 1930s, but many people are saying, including that old fella, that the country is going to the dogs now.
Well, I mean, the whole world is going to the dogs. I mean, the question is not... And Britain,
but he's not really talking
Britain
about
was
that,
not the
he?
Only
he's
country that
about,
fought in World War II, is it, as well?
He's talking about this country. And he's not, certainly not... He didn't mention in any way migration. He's just talking about... I mean, I think, you know, the sort of thing, the obvious thing, is the cost of living crisis, which is causing all sorts of trouble nowadays.
And that's caused by war as well, because the Americans blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They carried out the coup in the Ukraine. We've invaded Afghanistan. We've wrecked Syria. We've wrecked Libya. Economic adjustment that's been forced on Africa since the 1980s has impoverished the population. Yes, I mean, at the end of the Second World War, there were some social reforms in this country, like free healthcare, for example, council houses, scholarships to university. That's all gone. He's right about that.
That's probably, I think, what he's talking about. I mean, I think this is what many of the soldiers were voting for, a socialist government after World War II, and they've seen that vision squandered. One of the basic things, of course, is US power in this country is increasing all the time. What with bringing in nuclear weapons without telling anybody, trying to sneak them in, without the government debating it, without the public being told, as CND have been pointing out to Norfolk, basically. Then there's also, you go to the other end of the country, I didn't realise this, I'd heard nothing about it, but apparently the United States are planning a massive new air base in Pembrokeshire. Did you know about that, Martin? Had you heard about that?
No.
Well, a guy, I actually know this guy, I met him a couple of times, Gordon Main, he's a filmmaker, and he is a great little film which I'll share on our show page at thisweek.org.uk of Gordon on this beach over in Pembrokeshire saying, well, they're trying to build this massive road, but only, really, because they want access to this new airbase they haven't really told anybody about. So let's have a listen to Gordon now explaining the situation for the people in Pembrokeshire.
My name's Gordon Main. I'm one of the spokespeople for STUN, which is Stand Up for New Girl.
And what's the campaign about?
Well, the campaign is intimately related, we believe, with the Dark Project. It started several years ago when, to our great surprise, the council suddenly decided that this shingle bank is moving very quickly and wants to go up the valley and overtake the pub and engulf the road. Even though it's been stable here for many hundreds of years. And they have decided they want to build a massive new road going up the valley with a big bridge, trashing incredibly important, rich biodiverse habitat, and allow this to go into a more natural state, close down these businesses on the front. And there's been a solid sort of pushback against that. Because the science under it seems very, very, very suspect. It's all based on one report, which didn't use site-specific data to Newgale, and is coming off the 95th percentile, i.e. the very unlikely but extreme climate change that would see the sea rise by 1.1 metres or more here. That's not predicted to happen for another 100 years or so. So why the urgency, why this intense urgency for this shingle bank to be allowed to go, for the road to be removed, and a fast road going up there? And we think the only logical thing, for years we were thinking there must be something we don't know about happening beyond the road. And we had our suspicions about the barracks. And then this incredible project, which is an American base, American military base, appeared. And of course, once you start to read their data, you realize they need a much wider road and an easier road to get, even just for the construction phase, let alone for site security and to get the prefabricated things to install them. So we believe they're related. We believe they're locked together, and they should be one part of one big application so the people of Pembrokeshire can make a proper decision. Now, the real problem with these military bases, to my mind, is that America is a country which does not relinquish its military bases easily. So Wales would become, in effect, a client state. They would keep a very close eye on who was in power here, make sure that it never be possible for the Welsh people to close the base down or ask them to leave. And I think that's the real thing. That's why this is a pan-Wales issue. We should all wake up to it. Do we want to be another client state of the USA and intimately in their pocket forever? And do we also want to be part of what is ultimately an aggressive military stance to have 365 dominance of the whole of the world? And I don't think that's what the people of Wales, I don't think that's what the people of Pembrokeshire want. And this road is for that, as far as we know, and it's based on spurious science. What I'd just like to add, which is a separate thing, if you like, is that STUN we've done quite a lot of work. We've been commissioned expert reports, and we've actually worked up a very detailed planning application to solve what they are saying the problem is. If it's at face value, the problem is that we will have moderate sea level rise over the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years.
So there's Gordon Main, good old Gordon. Nice to hear it, see him and hear him doing his stuff. He's actually a terrific filmmaker. He made a terrific film about the British support for the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa in the 1980s and 90s. And so Gordon is a bit of a hero, a bit of a star. But there he is in Pembrokeshire, telling it like it is. The Americans want to build this base. Apparently, it's something to do with Space Force. The Americans have decided their Army Barracks is what is now quite a small site, is a preferred site for their deep space defence radar system. It's hoped to protect Britain from space warfare. Cawdor Barracks, next to Pembrokeshire Coast National Park, is earmarked for the Deep Space Advanced Radar Capability, DARC, that's DARC, as he was talking about there, programme, which is said to better detect and track objects in deep space up to 22,000 miles. You're yawning. So exciting. The programme, unveiled by the respective defence secretaries of Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States, is part of AUKUS security and defence partnership. But it's a bit sneaky of this lot to then say, oh, we're going to have to move your road because of climate change. Actually, it's nothing to do with that. It's because they want this whacking great American base in the national park.
And, of course, the British taxpayer is going to pay for the road so the Americans can have their base. Gosh, I want to see a dentist. I don't want a road in Pembrokeshire.
But this is a bit. This is part of the US dominance. Do you want to just say something about this, Martin? Because the Americans seem to be just calling the shots in Britain these days.
Well, they've been calling the shots for a long time, but of course it's getting worse. We're being integrated. You know, we're regarded very much as Airstrip 1, the unsinkable aircraft carrier, aren't we? At the same time, of course, Britain is actually, tries to establish its independence of the Americans by pushing harder than the Americans for a war against Russia, which, of course, is pretty idiotic.
Why don't we have all these Americans sort of marching us around on Remembrance Sunday around the Cenotaph, then?
Well, I think American military are sometimes represented in those events, are they not?
They're not telling us what to do. It seems they are basically able to do what they want here.
Well, they've been doing that since the end of the First World War.
It didn't happen in France, did it?
Well, it did to some extent. De Gaulle tried to defy them, but Macron won't even attempt it. What we're seeing now with what's happening off the coast of Venezuela is the US is trying to chuck its weight around because it's about to lose its dominant position in world politics, and they're not going to go without a fight. And that's the whole world is now going to have to turn on. We're going to have to deal with them as the Axis powers were dealt with in the 1940s.
Well, we're going to be talking about that after the break, but just before the break. What about Buckingham Palace? Great report from ITV News here. Seems like the royal family are getting it from all directions. The king of chaos and his vampire queen. How did a neo-Nazi end up working inside Buckingham Palace? A report from ITV News this week.
Tell me about your time at Buckingham Palace.
Yes, I worked there, worked for the royal family.
Did you tell them that you were a white supremacist?
I'm not a white supremacist.
So tell me what you are then. We spot him.
Okay, you ready?
Moving slowly through a London suburb and carrying secrets that are about to unravel. For now, he calls himself John, but not for much longer. Matthew Gravel.
Oh,
for months, he was the secretive spin doctor for a fascist fight club, Active Club England.
John, nice to meet you guys.
Which we infiltrated.
I am being racist today. Any photos we take, I will keep the faces out of it and I will blur them myself.
His mission, to spread the message but hide the man behind it.
And ultimately, if anyone's going to get in trouble for it, it'll be me.
But since then, he's aimed much higher. And now stands at the centre of a transatlantic network, meeting white supremacist leaders in the US to bring their tactics across the ocean. Your trip to America, what were you doing with the likes of Thomas Rousseau and Rob Rundeau?
Having conversations.
About what?
Various topics, my friend.
And there's another twist.
Why are you
because his route to America and back ran through an unlikely address. Tell me about your time at Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, so I worked there, worked for the royal family.
Did you tell them that you're a white supremacist?
I'm not a white supremacist.
So tell me what you are then.
I am an ethnocentrist. I believe in supporting and advocating the interests of my people, which is a people currently being driven to the verge of extinction.
Right.
And I have no interest in killing, hurting, violence, terrorism, anything like that.
Whichever label he chooses for himself, he was the neo-Nazi in the palace, with a secret role in another realm. This image was uploaded in September, and it shows his place in a new coalition. Right at the front, behind the blur, there he is, Matthew Gravel. When organisers posted this image of the men in matching outfits, they obscured the British visitors to protect their identities. But ITV News has now confirmed his. He'd travelled here to Texas to join the elite of global white supremacy. To the left, that's Robert Rundo, worldwide founder of the Active Club Network.
The beauty of the Active Club and what I call is the white nationalism 3.0 style, because it's very appealing. You know, you show the training. This is something that every man inherently craves.
Charged and eventually convicted in the US after years on the run in Europe. And to the right, Thomas Russo.
We need men who will grow.
Leader of Patriot Front, one of America's most organized and hardline neo-fascist groups.
Global invasion of foreigners.
Gravel's trip wasn't for sightseeing. He was here to learn and to bring their ideas to the UK.
It was really a who's who of the white supremacist moment today.
Experts in American far-right extremism say Gravel's presence at the conference shows how important he is.
This was all the prominent figures from groups that are highly active right now in white supremacy and who believe in the ethnic cleansing of countries. That's what's coming back to the UK with this connection.
Matthew Gravel and various other names he goes under. But Martin, just a little bit. I mean, apparently he was giving tours around Buckingham Palace as well, trusted by the royals.
Well, it's interesting. That's obviously the first I've heard of any of this. So, yes, I mean, obviously, regrettable things, surely.
But why the connection with the royal family?
Well, I don't know why the connection.
What about MI6? Might it have something to do with that? Might it be that the royal family has got rather fascist tendencies going within it?
Well, we know
that. They're happy to have someone who's a white supremacist working with them and for them, infiltrating fascist groups in Britain, such as Active Club England and Vanguard Britannia, with a direct link into Buckingham Palace.
Well, in the 1930s, we do know that people in the royal family were very sympathetic to Adolf Hitler.
Don't they have vetting?
Sorry?
Don't they have vetting? Maybe he's passed the vetting. And actually, yeah. If you're in Active Club England or a fascist group like Vanguard Britannia, that's a nice little tick for you when you're going to work at Buckingham Palace.
I couldn't possibly comment because that's speculation, Tony. Maybe so. And then you'd have thought there would be some vetting for people working in those kind of roles.
Well, of course there would be. Anyway, in a statement, to be fair, Buckingham Palace said, the royal household takes all such matters extremely seriously. However, as a matter of policy, we cannot comment on individual security issues. So they're really just saying, sorry. Do you think there may be maybe more of this sort of thing going on?
You are speculating that there's some connect. I mean, obviously, from his point of view.
So are ITV.
From his point of view.
Metro. So are all the papers that covered this.
Yes. Okay, well, it's obviously embarrassing for Buckingham Palace that they've got a neo-Nazi working board.
Well, it's not that embarrassing. All they're saying is we weren't going to comment. You would have thought that they would have at least something to say about it if there's a reasonable excuse. There clearly is no reasonable excuse.
Well, the question is what is the vetting procedure, isn't it?
Well,
is the one?
It's not very good, and in fact, it's probably, as I said, that part of the vetting is that we rather like it if you're a neo-Nazi. Ode this week: Nazis at the palace, buck the trend. Oh, what a game to live their lives in wealth and fame. Down you go, if you dare. Get in their way, their lives contraire. Behind the walls so dark and damp, wild faces roam. Do Nazis camp in large rooms of guilt and pomp, where Charlie screams, kicks and stomps? Who goes there, friend or foe, in dungeons deep where servants go, to bow and scrape and kiss their feet, while others there to headlines greet? Nazis working at the palace. How many more disasters? Malice. PR teams on high alert quash the rumours, bury dirt, as lives of Riley must not hurt. A warden said who worked the crowds when asked, an ethnocentrist proud within the walls talked history, a conspiracy or mystery, a plot gung-ho to bring them down, sell up, downsize and flog the crowns. Who knows the dirty dealings done, but what a farce to watch. What fun. Thank you, Patricia. Martin, I'll give a final word to you, though. Are you surprised to find fascists inside Buckingham Palace working away, beavering away in there, or not?
I'm interested to know what procedures they have for vetting such people. And if they, you know, are there a vetting, is there a vetting procedure, or can anybody just apply for these jobs? How does it work? I would presume that there would be vetting, in which case they would have known that he was a neo-Nazi. So there we are.
H-A-T-E. It was with this left hand that old brother Cain struck the blow that laid his brother low. L-O-V-E. The right hand, friends, the hand of love. Now watch and I'll show you the story of life. These fingers, dear hearts, is always a warring and a tugging, one against the other. Now watch them. Old brother left hand. Left hand hates a fighting. And it looks like love's a goner. Wait a minute. Hot dog, love's a winning. Yes, sirree. It's love that won. And old left hand hate is down for the count.
Well, it's time for me to say goodbye and turn the other cheek. And head out of the Abernathy building, down the street, past the church, and down to Samson's Diner. And in the meantime, eat, drink, and be merry, and forgive them, for they know not what they do. We'll see you next week on Theme Time Radio Hour. Amen.
You've been listening to Theme Time Radio Hour with your host, Bob Dylan. Produced by Eddie Gorodetsky. Associate producer, Sonny Webster. Continuity by Eats Martin. Edited by Damian Rodriguez. Supervising editor, Rob McComber. The Theme Time research team, Diane Lapson and Bernie Bernstein. With additional research by Lynn Sheridan, Kimberly Williams, and Robert Bauer. Production assistance by Jim McBean. Special thanks to Randy Esrati, Debbie Sweeney, Coco Shinomiya, and Samson's Diner. For XM Radio, Lee Abrams. Recorded in Studio B, the Abernathy Building. This has been a Greywater Park production in association with Big Red Tree. This is your announcer, Pierre Mancini, speaking. Join us again next week for Theme Time Radio Hour, and the subject is Musical Map.
Remember, blessed are the peacemakers.
What was that? I don't know. I think it was blessed are the cheesemakers.
Nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you. Try to tell me thoughts they cannot defend. Just what you want to be, you
in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I've always missed, with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say.
Everybody stand up.
like Brigitte Bardot. Now look at the people in the streets, in the bars. We are all of us in the gutter. Some of us are looking at the stars. Look round the room. Life is unkind. We fall, but we keep getting up. The heavens above. Talk to me, darling, with a message of love. Now the reason we're here, every man, every woman, is to help each other, stand by each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up.
So from 1981, it's Chrissie Hynde, The Pretenders. Lots of attitude. Yeah, quite forthright, isn't she? With a message of love. And before that, we heard What the World Needs Now on a similar topic from Jackie Del Shannon. And that's from 1965. But first, well, we heard the sort of tail end of that Bible thing from Theme Time Radio Hour with Bob Dylan. But the first song was The Moody Blues, 1967, Nights in White Satin. And so welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show or the Bristol Politics Show. As we transition with our Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So what about, I think our first piece, our first thing this week, Martin, has probably got to be about this. I mean, there are several biggies this week that haven't really got much coverage at all. The British MI6, apparently, in a plot using British taxpayers' money to attempt to steal. And this is why the Russians are getting so annoyed, is because apparently the British were trying to help the Ukrainians and egg them on to steal a MiG-31 fighter jet, but the Russians strung them along and foiled the plot.
Well, as I understand it, I've obviously been reading about this, they were going to pay the Russian pilot of the MiG $3 million if he would cooperate in the plot. And the idea, what the Russian FSB are saying is that they then intended to use the MiG to attack a target inside Romania so that they could then say, oh, we're under direct attack from the Russians. You know, Britain and America have got to join in on the Ukrainian side because they're in desperate straits now.
So this is to start World War III.
That's right.
Right, so that's the plot. Now, and then one of the reasons we're told we're not allowed to see RT anymore, which Martin and I used to be on regularly, is because here is a report now through the firewall of what RT had to say about this little plot by MI6 and the Ukrainians to steal a MiG-31 to start the Third World War.
A false flag operation fabricated by Ukrainian military intelligence, along with the UK's MI6, was supposed to produce so-called undeniable proof that the Russian Air Force violated NATO territory while fully armed with its latest state-of-the-art hypersonic ballistic missile Kinzhal. One major obstacle was the fact that the perpetrators lacked the evidence. An actual combat-ready MiG-31 interceptor carrying a hypersonic Kinzhal missile. The plan was to steal one along with the crew who were supposed to commit state treason for a price of $3 million and a carefree life outside of Russia. That failed operation began a year ago.
In the fall of 2024, an unknown person contacted me via the Telegram messenger, introducing himself as Sergei Lugovsky, a member of the international investigative journalism agency Bellingcat. To prove his identity, Sergei later sent me his press card and offered to pay for a confidential consultation on military-related topics. I believe his true intention was to compromise me for intelligence purposes. For example, during one conversation, Sergei mentioned a payment allegedly for military information I had provided, with the money to be transferred to my personal bank account. I decline to continue any further communication or contact with Sergei.
I represent the Bellingcat Project. I'm sure you've heard of it. We specialize in investigative journalism, analyzing information from both open sources and eyewitness accounts. Currently, our editorial focus is on military topics. More specifically, we seek to obtain information from military personnel anonymously. Naturally, due to various reasons, those serving or involved in mobilization efforts often face different challenges during their duties. May I ask if it's possible to pay your fee via a bank card rather than cryptocurrency? Our account, as I mentioned, sometimes gets blocked or frozen. Paying this way would be much easier for me.
The Bellingcat Research's accreditation was issued in Warsaw, yet another indication that the perpetrator's arm reaches even farther to the west of Ukraine. According to the FSB, this so-called investigative group has nothing to do with real journalism.
In many ways, Ukrainian main Directorate of Intelligence representatives acted predictably. For cover when approaching the commander of the airship, the intelligence service used the so-called journalistic organization Bellingcat, which had already come under our scrutiny and is controlled by British intelligence. What Bellingcat really is was clearly demonstrated in 2022 by one of its operatives, British intelligence agent Christo Grosin. At that time, he was involved in a similar, also failed, Ukrainian main Directorate of Intelligence operation to hijack a Su-34 fighter jet. He arranged for money to be sent to Russia through intermediaries for a Russian military pilot who supposedly agreed to cooperate with intelligence.
After failing to flip the Russian MiG-31 commander, Ukrainian military intelligence and their handlers moved on to a second crewman, the navigator. His role and the fact that it was physically and technically impossible for him to land the plane are paramount to the story of a widely used but undeniable deceit. You will know why in a moment, but first, here is what he was offered in exchange for killing his commander and landing the plane somewhere in the Odessa region.
I was offered $1 million for successfully hijacking the aircraft. Later, this was increased to $3 million if the plane equipped with a Kinzhal missile was delivered. To entice me and assert their importance, they even sent photos and videos showing large sums of cash supposedly prepared for me after the hijacking.
I offered you $3 million for the jet with Kinzhal.
Russia's FSB took control of the recruitment attempts from the moment the pilots were contacted and began a counter-operation while the pilots themselves returned to their duties. Russian agents began their very long and meticulous game with a man using the handle Leon, which culminated in the other side's agent admitting that he cooperates with the British secret intelligence.
I work for the Intelligence Directorate of the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine. Your security will be ensured by our British partners. Yes, the partners will be involved. SIS, Secret Intelligence Service.
So there you go. That's part of the RT report about this. But, I mean, this is just so... this is the stuff the spies get up to, isn't it? But they're trying to... This is our taxpayers' money. The attempt is to... start World War III. That's what seems to be the mission. So the British have obviously decided, when something like this comes out, right, they can decide one or the other thing at the Foreign Office. I'm sure there'd be all these sorts of fraught meetings about, oh, God, that, you know, everything's gone wrong. But they've decided to say nothing about it, to just completely pretend that it never happened. They could have issued some sort of denial, but they haven't even done that.
Well, that's because most people don't know about it in the Western media bubble. So, you know, we're covering it. RT have covered it, but I doubt whether anybody else has covered it. I don't think, you know, it's quite obvious why they would want to try and get hold of a MiG and a Kinzhal missile, whether they were going to use them for anything or not. Yeah? You might want to get hold of a Kinzhal missile.
You see, so the British could say, this is just part of normal spying. Well, we want to get hold of some Russian tech so we can see what they've got.
That's right.
They haven't said that at all.
No, well, they haven't said anything either way, as you've just said. What the Russians are claiming is that the plan was to use the missile to attack something in Romania and then claim that the Russians had done it so that they could then... No, it's certainly the case that MI6 have been involved in provocations inside the Russian Federation, including the Crocus massacre in Crocus Theatre, in which 100 and some odd people were shot dead, and also the killing of Kirillov, who's a general. But of course, you'd say that's legitimate. He's a general. Are British generals fair game? You know, it's like saying to the Israelis, you go around killing all these people who are at the top level of other countries. That means you're all fair game, doesn't it? Now, I think the question is, both sides could be lying here. This is a hall of mirrors. But of course, the British are indeed engaged in terrorist activities inside Russia. And if they were to carry out terrorist activities inside Britain, it'd just be a quid pro quo. Maybe we need a big massacre by Muslims in a theatre that kills 120 people, because the people who escaped from that were heading for Ukraine. They weren't heading back to Tajikistan where they'd been recruited, but the Russians caught them. And that is actually, and they're very clear in saying that was the SBU, Ukrainian Secret Service, working with MI6. Well, MI6 are terrorists. People are not going to be surprised to hear that in West Belfast.
Yeah, they aren't. So last week we played we discussed footage from a drone which was released of another drone killing these pensioners who were trying to surrender in the east of Ukraine. I think it was up in the Kharkov region somewhere.
They weren't trying to surrender. They were just trying to get out of the way behind the Russian lines.
They had a white flag.
Yes, they're trying to get behind Russian lines.
They had a white flag, and they're pensioners, and they're just trying to get out of this awful city that's been surrounded.
Yeah.
And then the drones kill both of them. And it's pretty harrowing footage. But this was covered by Channel 4 News this week, a few days after we covered it. And they, of course, went along the lines of, well, this is a Russian drone killing people. So this is just Porek O'Brien, I think he is, the correspondent there, checking his facts, because this video came out the day before from Russian sources showing this. And then the next day it was overlaid with footage from the Ukrainians claiming that these were Russian drones killing Ukrainians, not Ukrainian drones killing Ukrainians. Anyway, without checking his facts, this is what Porek O'Brien put out this week on Channel 4 News about that specific incident. No.
This is the world of would-be war crimes gamified. Russian drone operators attacking Ukrainian civilians. Posted to their socials, set it to music. Everywhere in Ukraine is now the front line, and every Ukrainian is living on it.
Ми обичні, звичайні люди, громадяни, такі ж, як і вони. Ми для них, як вони говорять, що ми не люди.
But there's more. We're told that the Russian military is using civilians as target practice to train novice drone operators.
Професіонали полюють за бабусями або дідусями, які живуть або їдуть на велосипеді.
This is not a game. It's a place where ordinary people drive at breakneck speed to try to get ahead of death by drone. Last week, the Ukrainians released this footage. It shows a man walking along a road in the Kharkiv region with his dog. He's holding a white flag. A drone flies at him and explodes, killing both him and the animal. Further up the road, a second man, also with a white flag, sees what's just happened. crosses himself, then is also killed. This is one of several incidents that Ukrainian prosecutors are investigating as possible war crimes committed by Russian drone operators.
As you say, Russian drone operators. No, Mr. Channel 4 News, you're fake news. That's what you are. And you're lying about whose drones they were, because they're Russian drones. At least that's certainly what it appears. Well, the Russian drone is filming the Ukrainian drone killing pensioners. Yeah. But so this is what we're getting from our mainstream press, which is hardly surprising that they're getting the BBC are getting sued for $1 billion over this Donald Trump thing. But I mean, in the back of that, in the background to this, the Guardian this week came out with a Ukrainian computer game style drone attack system goes viral. The system rewards Ukrainian soldiers who achieve strikes with points that can be used to buy more weapons in an online store. So a computer game style drone attack system has gone viral among Ukrainian military units and is being extended to reconnaissance, artillery and logistics operations, the first Deputy Prime Minister Mykhailo Fedorov has told The Guardian. Drone teams competing for points under the Army of Drones bonus system kill or wounded 18,000 Russian soldiers. So they're using a sort of reward system, saying, well, look, this is a game. You just, if you kill more Russians, you will get rewarded. You'll get special points. And in fact, you'll get more power in this game.
Well, I mean, what we're getting is a very different version of events from what's happening, from what the Russian population have been getting. So, for example, during the invasion of the Kursk region, I saw loads of videos of people, you know, the Russian soldiers finding loads of locals who'd clearly been executed. You know, they'd been hands tied behind their backs, they'd been shot in the head, they'd been blown up. And, of course, that's on primetime TV in Russia. We're being given the opposite sort of propaganda, where the Russians are being accused of just killing people at random for the sake of it. And, of course, in actual fact, the death toll of civilians in the Ukraine war compared to military casualties is actually quite small compared to what's going on in Gaza, for example. Far less civilians
are being killed. So who's paying for all these drones Ukrainians are using in this game to kill Russia?
We are, Tony.
The system
I haven't seen a dentist in years, but we can afford to pay them to build these drones and kill people.
The system, which launched more than a year ago, rewards soldiers who achieve strikes with points that can be exchanged to buy more weapons in an Amazon for War online store called Brave One, filled with more than 100 different drones, autonomous vehicles and other drone war material. It's got a leader board topped by teams with names such as Achilles and Phoenix. Is a truly popular among units, says Fedorov. The system, which is a prime example of the increasing automation of warfare, all the defense forces know about this, and there's a competition for the points for getting these drones, electronic warfare systems. So what seems to be going on here is if you can kill more Russians, you get the latest tech.
Yes, it's an incentive system, what we're being given is a load of fluff and propaganda about how the Ukrainians, how brilliant the Ukrainians are, how clever they are, how they're much more adept than their Russian counterparts, who are all just.
It's not necessarily clear that it's Ukrainians who are actually driving these drones either. It could be Americans, it could be Germans. You know that EUCOM is based in Stuttgart, Germany. It was Glenn Greenwald many years ago that discovered that many of the drones being used in places like Yemen and Afghanistan were actually being controlled via Stuttgart.
That's right. And, of course, the Ukrainians are basically integrated into NATO at every level, including being directly advised by MI6 at our expense. The problem they've got is that the reality is they are losing, and losing badly. They're now creating all. I mean, the propaganda from the Ukrainian side has been almost blatant from the very beginning. You had all of these people of PR companies who gave their services for free to the Ukrainians about how to, get the Western people on side to support their cause. And of course, there's been just lie after lie from the Ukrainian side. Anybody remember the Ghost of Kiev, which was supposedly a brave pilot who went up every night in his MiG and shot down loads and loads of Russian planes and then suddenly pointed out, actually, that's from a computer game. And the Ukrainians said, yes, it is a computer game, but it was necessary because we need to keep morale up. So they openly say, we lie in order to keep morale up, but that's okay, it's a war, you're allowed to lie in war. Now, you are allowed to lie in war, but in a war, you shouldn't be caught. If you're going to lie, don't get caught. You know, 11th commandment.
Talking about Germany, there's been in this quite an interesting spate of deaths of people from the Alternative for Deutschland party, and Redacted did take a look at that this week.
Why are so many German AfD party members winding up dead? Well, we covered this story months ago after about six or so AfD right-leaning conservative party members died unexpectedly. It seemed odd. Well, since we covered that story, we've had another five conservatives who are basically in the opposition against the government establishment. 11 of them. Like, who is... Someone's got to be killing these people, right? Because it doesn't add up at all. Dr. John Campbell says it's statistically impossible for this to be happening. Watch.
Of course, there's a time to be born and there's a time to die. And none of us know specifically when we'll die, but we can work it out based on populations and demographics and age profiles and predisposing conditions, how likely death is. And using those criteria, it's very unlikely that these deaths would have occurred in Germany, essentially spontaneously. These 11 deaths that occurred in Germany were all in opposition party candidates, seven of whom were AfD. Alternative for Deutschland. So if you haven't got time to watch this video, the bottom line is that this is mathematically very improbable, and yet it has happened.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. These AfD party members are a threat to the socialist government of Germany, who want to close their borders and end these ridiculous green energy policies. And they want Germany to stop supporting Nazis in Ukraine. They want Germany first, and that's why they're a threat. Someone else who the government thinks is a threat is Naomi Seitz. She's a journalist from Germany who's now seeking asylum from President Trump in the United States because Germany is coming after her for telling the truth. Naomi, welcome back to the show. Great to see you.
Hi, great to see you too. Thank you so much for having me on again.
First, yeah, I want to hear, you know, I want to get to your story and why you're seeking this asylum. But first, on this AfD question, it seems like the German government is saying nothing to see here. We've investigated this. Nothing odd at all for 11 people to just drop dead who happen to be in the opposition. Do you agree with the German government's assessment of this?
I will say they like to call me the right-wing conspiracy theorist, but even I doubted this claim that they were killed for a very long time, because I thought to myself, okay, let's wait a minute, let's at least investigate. But then they didn't want to investigate. And then more and more AfD members died. At first they told us, but these people, the ones that were killed or died specifically, they were older than 60, even though I would argue I know a lot of people who get much older than 60. Some of them, or at least one of them, had cancer. But then you also have to consider, if they actually did intend to kill that many AfD members, they would have to make sure that they have some sort of alibi. It would be very suspicious if all of these AfD members were like 30 years old.
Yeah, it certainly would. Anyway, I'll put the full version of that up on our show page from Redacted. Martin, it's a little bit suspicious, isn't it? Particularly in Germany, the home of the ex-Nazis. But most importantly here, this is right in the front line, the Germans are, with this Ukraine war. They're threatening to supply these missiles, long-range missiles. The German economy is absolutely on its knees as a result of the destroying the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, and so there's an enormous political battle going on in Germany as to whether to go to war with Russia or not.
Well, that's right, and of course it may be. I mean, the AfD obviously are a nuisance to those who want to ramp up military spending, and I don't think they really want to have a war with Russia.
They're against it, the AfD.
Now, the AfD, I'm just saying that the establishment in the West are talking up the Russian threat so that they can spend an awful lot of money on weaponry. Whether they really understand what going to war with Russia would actually mean is another question. Did they kill these people? I don't know. Is it possible? Certainly is.
Okay. So also, there's the climate coming into this now. We're going to look at the COP Brazil thing, which all seems to be sort of petering out, this whole sort of climate conference thing. Is King Charles over there?
I don't know.
I think it's William, isn't it, that went this time. So Charles has realised that it's a bit of a toxic thing, so he's sending his little boy to go there. But anyhow, the most important thing about this to me this year is that just as they tried to open their climate summit in Brazil, so it was stormed by a whole bunch of indigenous people who were having their land taken over for carbon offsets. So let's have a listen to a report on that now from the BBC.
Dozens of indigenous protesters carrying batons have forced their way into the venue that's hosting the COP30 climate talks in Brazil. The protesters chanted slogans about indigenous land rights and clashed with the security guards and police at the entrance to the convention centre in Belém. Angela Gudgell reports.
It started as a carnival atmosphere outside the COP30 conference in Belém in Brazil, with protesters calling for more action on climate change.
They're breaching through. They're going towards the COP venue.
Then dozens forced their way into the venue, where they were outnumbered by police and security. They carried placards and flags saying our forests are not for sale.
We came here in a protest to show them that the COP is for the people and the people must be there. All peoples of all colors, all ethnicity, because they need to hear us.
The protesters were mainly from indigenous communities based around the Amazon region where the UN summit's taking place. Many are critical of the damage caused by development and deforestation and feel their voices aren't being heard, despite Brazil's President Lula saying they would be front and centre of this year's talks. Security guards pushed the protesters back, but at least two people were hurt. And the break-in will concern the organisers of the summit, which attracts high-profile politicians every year, such as Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and thousands of delegates from almost 200 countries. A UN spokesperson said the venue had been secured and negotiations continue. And Jana Gadgil, BBC News.
Well, our climate and science reporter Esme Stallard is at the COP conference in Belém and sent us this update just after the protest had happened.
Well, as Gavin Newsom was speaking, those protests were taking place. Videos have started to appear on social media, which show a group of indigenous protesters marching from the city of Belém through to the entrance to this venue. We can then see in the videos that they kick down the doors and attempt to storm the entrance. At that point, they're met by local police and UN security who attempt to push them back. Now, witnesses spoken to the Reuters news agency say that they saw a security guard being wheeled away in a wheelchair, clutching his stomach, and that another security guard reported being hit by an object from the crowd. It now looks like those crowds have been completely dispersed and we're not hearing any more reports of injuries. But obviously, this will worry UN security. These annual climate summits attract tens of thousands of people every year, including very high-level diplomats that have been here, such as Gavin Newsom from the US. And so they will be looking into why this storming was able to happen and how they could get past security.
Esme Stallard there.
So that's the BBC report on it, Martin. This is just a kind of report that popped up in late in the evening earlier this week, but then it didn't get kind of picked up very much in the morning. So you could argue, oh, this is just a little blip. But actually, these people, these indigenous people, were supposed to be front and centre of this COP meeting. But actually, they've decided, no, we're not going to be used as puppets by you. We're going to point out that these carbon offset policies, the net zero and carbon trading policies, are destroying our indigenous land.
Well, I'd like to know what the demands of these protesters were, because are they, you know, what are they actually complaining about? But of course, inevitably, in a country like Brazil, where you've got all these social conflicts and tensions, when you've got an international audience there, this is a chance to get whatever it is.
So you're implying that they just turned up because it's a chance to get on the TV?
No. They've got their legitimate concerns. Well, I don't really know what they are from what we just heard. Yeah. Obviously, they're concerned.
I did tell you. I mean, they're having land taken by carbon offset companies.
All right. Well, in that case, I can understand why they're protesting. And of course, that's why the, you know, that's what happens. And of course, Brazil is just about a democratic country, and therefore they've got a right to have a go, haven't they?
So let's, I mean, if you want, I will share this article by Reuters about this. I mean, it's not all that long. And it was on the 12th of November, that's Wednesday, late. It was shared. Dozens of indigenous protesters forced their way into COP on Tuesday evening and clashed with security guards at the entrance to demand climate action and forest protection. They demanded access to the UN compound where thousands of delegates and countries all around the world, the climate summit in Belém. The slogans are calling for land rights and our land is not for sale. We can't eat money, said one of the indigenous leaders from the Tupinamba community, who uses only one name. We want our lands free from these agribusiness, oil exploitation, miners and logging.
Security, so it's not about climate change.
Well, they were, yes. Mm-hmm. There's also something in there about, mm-hmm, about the carbon offset, their lands being taken over. Security guards pushed the protesters back and used tables. Another guard with a fresh cut above his eye told Reuters he'd been hit in the head with a heavy drumstick. So anyway, it's not very, it's a bit embarrassing. Maybe Charlie caught wind of this and decided he wasn't going to go. It's very embarrassing, isn't it, to have a big protest like this at their nice little neat and tidy gathering.
I would say it's to be expected. I mean, there's massive, Sue Branford and Oriel Glock wrote a book years ago about land rights in the Amazon. It's a huge conflict between the indigenous communities and the garimpeiros, who are illegal miners, the ranchers, who are cutting down trees to make, burgers, and all sorts of other. I mean, basically, there's a lot of tension.
These indigenous people see this, and it's interesting that they came storming in. Maybe it's pure coincidence, as Gavin Newsom was starting to speak. But they see the United States as just using and abusing all sorts of international agreements like this to destroy them.
Well, I agree that, they probably do see the United States as the enemy, because, of course, they were behind the coup in 1964 in Brazil and the military dictatorship, which actually put the roads into the Amazon for its strategic reasons, which then led to knock-on effects on the indigenous communities in the Amazon. But, you know, Brazil is a very divided society. The very wealthy in Brazil are very wealthy and the very poor are very poor. And most of the land is in the hands of latifundista, who are big landowners.
Well, if we go just a little bit north of Brazil, where do we find ourselves?
Venezuela.
So Trump has been presented with options to bomb Venezuela. Hexeth announces a military campaign, Operation Southern Spear. A family of fishermen killed by the US military want justice, and the White House insiders know of 2020 Venezuelan coup in advance. So the Venezuelans are starting to think to themselves, well, okay, so you've calmed things down in Gaza, Mr. Trump, but you're trying to start a war with Venezuela.
Well, both Venezuela and Colombia have taken a strong line in support of Palestine. So Gustavo Petro, who's the Colombian president, he's been made most persona non grata. And, of course, they've started whacking fishermen both in Colombia and Venezuela. And, in fact, J.D. Vance was on video talking to his supporters, saying, well, if I was a fisherman, I wouldn't be going fishing at this time. So, in other words, they know they're killing fishermen. This is absolute mass murder signed off by J.D. Vance and Donald Trump, and in actual fact, it should lead to prosecution, conviction and execution under existing U.S. law. But it's not going to, is it? It's
so, what do you make of the Duran? Do you ever see the Duran? Do you ever read it?
I'm vaguely aware of it.
Yeah. Anyway, Alexander Mercuris is from the Duran, and he was interviewed this week about Venezuela. What's going on there?
All right, Alexander, let's talk about the USS Ford Carrier Group, which, according to various reports, is now in the region of Venezuela. It's in the Caribbean, and it's heading towards Venezuela. What do you think we're going to see?
Well, indeed.
Are we going to get some sort of a military operation now that this carrier is in the area, or could this be some sort of a bluff or a routine rotation or something going on here? What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that a couple of days ago, we were getting all of these reports that Trump had second thoughts about the Venezuela operation. And it looked for a time as if the Ford had stopped steaming towards the Caribbean and was staying off the coast of Morocco. And a lot of people seized on that and said that this is proof that the U.S. is not going to intervene in Venezuela after all. And we warned in a program that we did that we need to be very careful with this administration because they will say one thing and do the opposite. They have shown in the past that they can give the impression that they're pulling back when in actual fact, they're moving forward. Now, the Ford is now in the Caribbean. There is no other reason why it would be there than in order to conduct an attack against Venezuela. If you're going to start intercepting, speedboats carrying drugs, you do not deploy a U.S. Navy carrier, the biggest, most powerful, most modern Navy carrier in the U.S. Navy for that purpose with all its escorts. They're clearly there, it seems to me, to build up the pressure against Venezuela and to prepare for an attack. And this is the question. I don't believe that you send a whole carrier steaming around the coast of Venezuela just in order to bluff. It's a massively expensive thing to do, incredibly costly thing to do. If you simply pull it back, then you're going to look ridiculous. It's a point we've made in the past. So the fact that the Ford has now joined the already existing very powerful task group that was already positioned close to Venezuela's coastline suggests to me that an attack is indeed coming.
Yeah, I don't think there's been any pullback from the other ships that are in the area. Has there been any reported pullback or anything? They've stayed put.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly correct. I haven't heard any pullback at all. On the contrary, this force is now growing. I understand that something like 15% of the U.S. Navy, which is a huge and very powerful Navy, is now deployed off the coast of Venezuela.
Okay, so that's Alexander Mercuris from the Duran explaining the situation there to us rather well. I like his style. I just like the way, yes, well, it's not really, this is a massive aircraft carrier. You don't need a massive aircraft carrier to make moves against fishermen.
No, you don't. And of course, they don't claim that they claim these people are trying to carry drugs to the United States
Talking about the previous coup attempt in Venezuela, which was, I think, was in under Hugo Chavez. And they're saying, the Americans knew all about it.
Various attempts to remove them.
It's got a lot of oil, Venezuela, isn't it?
You know, and it's also they don't like anybody doing anything they don't like, you know, because it gives people ideas. If the Venezuelans are allowed to get away with stuff, everybody was starting to get away with stuff, you know. So that's, as I said earlier, the Americans are now lashing out over the world.
On the 16th of October, something happened. It was the resignation of U.S. military Southcom stepped down. Admiral Alvin Halsey is leaving just a year, or has left just less than a year into his tenure as the Pentagon escalates attacks against Venezuela. So there he is. I think in a way he should be a hero because he's one of the Pentagon's people who's part of Southcom, and he's saying, look, I'm not up for this. You know what I mean? You're trying to start a war here. That's not where we're here to defend America, not to start World War III in South America.
Well, it may be that, or it may be that he just doesn't want to take responsibility for it. What he should do is not resign. He should have said, we're not doing it. You've got to sack me. But then, of course, you lose your pension. So he's not going to do that.
And also, he loses any chance of going somewhere else. So maybe I would transfer him somewhere else. So he can carry on being the sort of person he is, who's not necessarily going to do what Trump wants to start another war. The military commander overseeing the Pentagon's escalating attacks against boats in the Caribbean Sea. But the Trump administration says the smuggling drugs is stepped down. He's leaving his job as head of the U.S. Southern Command, which oversees all operations in Central and South America, even as the Pentagon has rapidly built up some 10,000 forces in the region and what it says is counteracting drugs and counteracting terrorism. So he hasn't said why. He's had a 37-year career. So this is, it's a great opportunity to talk about unified command structure, which is this American map of the world, where they have rather arrogantly, the Pax Americana types, drawn little lines dividing the world up into regions. We mentioned EUCOM earlier on, didn't we? The Stuttgart-based organisation which is helping Zelensky.
It's not called EUCOM. It's called something else, but I know what you mean. Eurocom, perhaps. CENTCOM.
There are various other ones. I think CENTCOM is actually to do with the Middle East. Yeah. But anyway, the whole world has been divided up into the unified command structure. The Americans have made it very obvious. We intend to control the world, actually. And this is our little map. And it's one of those regions of the world the Americans intend to control through the Pentagon and through the unified command structure, where that guy has just resigned. And that is where this all this trouble is happening in Venezuela. So it seems to me that there are some members of the military who just think this is a ludicrous thing that Trump is doing.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of people in the US. I mean, if you look at public opinion in the US, they're very anti having a war with Venezuela on both sides of the aisle. I mean, the excuse they're coming up with, that Maduro is a narco-terrorist, is absolutely lame. The main controllers of the international drugs trade, particularly cocaine, are the CIA. And we've got evidence going back years of their involvement in it. To his great credit, Gustavo Petro has made these points. He's the elected president of Colombia, and until very recently there was civil war going on in Colombia, and there's still loads of conflict there. Hundreds of thousands of people have died, millions have been displaced. They know what war is. I went in Colombia in 2005. They know what it's about. Does Trump? The answer is probably not.
So, looking at this sort of attempt at US hegemony, one of the people who's been writing for many years about this, I think he started off as Land Destroyer. Do you know who I'm talking about? Tony Cartolucci, I think he was called.
Yes, that's right.
We haven't had interviews with him on this program for several years, but he's still going strong. I think he's come out with his real name, apparently another name, not Tony Cartolucci. Is it somebody Berletic?
Brian Berletic.
Brian Berletic, that's right. Yeah. Anyway, here's one of his latest, looking at this whole thing of the attempt by the United States as their empire goes down to try to carry on dominating the world, which is bound to fail.
The U.S. is essentially waging an undeclared war against all of these countries. And because it cannot get what it wants directly from these countries, it is targeting their allies they believe are too far flung for these nations to help defend it. They're probably right about that. And we're probably going to watch Venezuela suffer serious death and destruction, if not a total collapse of the government, because of this, because nothing has fundamentally changed. The U.S. is still pursuing this singular obsession of global primacy. They are not getting what they want because they are an empire in decline. And so they are looking for other ways, more indirect ways, to try to reassert their domination over the planet and remove from the board allies, partners, potential partners from this growing multipolar world to further isolate it, to give the U.S. a better chance of reasserting itself over it and containing multipolarism before it irreversibly ascends over U.S.-led hegemony. When the U.S. has recalibrated its policy of encirclement and containment of China, it will sidestep any agreements it has made and will relaunch any and all measures it thinks will undermine China's rise both within its borders and, well, beyond them. How many times have we seen the U.S. make all kinds of agreements with Russia, with China, with Iran? It was in the middle of making an agreement with Iran when it, through Israel, struck at Iran, attempted a decapitation campaign aimed at its military, scientific, and political leadership, and then the U.S. itself attacked Iran in open, again, war of aggression against Iran. And so that is what they will do with China. And they're already openly doing it. And China knows this. It's just, do these analysts in the West, including in the alternative media, do they understand this? Or do they just not care? That's a question we have to ask ourselves. The U.S. doesn't do diplomacy. How much more obvious does this need to be for people to understand this? There is no diplomacy. The U.S. has no concept of diplomacy. Instead, what it does is buy time and space to create conditions that may not currently be optimal to achieve its long-term objective. That objective always has been and continues to be global primacy and the elimination of all rivals, adversary and ally alike. Unless this fundamental objective and the interests driving it change, and they aren't, and they won't anytime in the near future, the only thing about U.S. policy that will change are the ways it attempts to pursue this and nothing else. Okay, so it's very important to understand that. And now, no sooner did I post this than the next day, I was looking at a couple of things, actually. I was looking at, first of all, I've been tracking the U.S. buildup for war with Venezuela. So, again, people thinking that Trump is turning this around and he's breaking free from decades of U.S. Pursuit of primacy, even as he's openly planning to attack and overthrow the government of Venezuela. But there are all of these other aspects that demonstrate nothing at all has changed in terms of U.S. foreign policy objectives, just the approach they're taking to try to achieve them. And so I posted that. Then I received an email from someone in Malaysia, and they were asking me to look into Malaysia's Anwar Ibrahim. Now, I have been warning about him for years because, as you can see in this picture right here, he has been a U.S. National Endowment for Democracy stooge. I don't know what other word to use for years and years. This is him literally in Washington, D.C., hanging out with the National Endowment for Democracy. Here's Carl Gershman, the former head of the National Endowment for Democracy. There he is, in case you... Is that Anwar Ibrahim? Yes, that's Anwar Ibrahim. He's a panelist, and he's a frequent attendee at NED events in the United States, and also his whole political movement in Malaysia has been built up by the National Endowment for Democracy, George Soros' Open Society, all the NED subsidiaries like the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute. They literally built up his whole political movement, and they got it into power. And then there was a point where Malaysia's own deeply seated interests, they tried to maybe win him over or collaborate with him, maybe trying to neutralize his loyalty, his allegiance to the United States. And then people were telling me, look, Brian, Anwar Ibrahim, he's meeting with China. You're completely wrong about him. I'm not wrong about him. He literally is working with and for the National Endowment for Democracy. This is indisputable.
So that's Brian Beletich, who's finally come out with his real name after becoming Land Destroyer and then becoming Tony Cartolucci. You say he's a former Marine, U.S. Marine.
That's what I understand. Obviously,
according to Wikidata, God knows who they are. They say he's a former U.S. Marine electro optical ordnance repairman.
Well, there you are. So he has been.
But what about
what
he's saying? What about what he's saying there?
Well, I mean, I'm interested to hear what he's saying. Anwar Ibrahim is part of the. I can't remember the name of the party, but it's the same party as Mahathir Mohamad. And he and Mahathir Mohamad fell out at one stage, and Anwar Ibrahim was put in prison by Mahathir Mohamad because Mahathir Mohamad is regarded by the US as an unreliable nationalist.
He was the guy who, under his presidency or prime ministership, I can't remember which it was in Malaysia, They conducted the war crime trials of Tony Blair and George Bush and Zippy Livni.
They did, yes. And they also, one of the things they did during the 1998 crisis, which was actually orchestrated again by Wall Street, BlackRock, etc., is they brought in exchange controls, which just, you know, used to be normal all over the world. And they, in actual fact, they didn't suffer as badly from the crisis as other Southeast Asian countries. So the main support of the US in Thailand and Malaysia, in Malaysia, it's been to Shinawatra and various others. I mean, they try and bribe, you know, it's what they used to say in Mexico, piombo or prato, you know, silver or lead. Yeah. You do what we want, we will reward you. You don't know what we want.
He's got a book out, Beletic. It's called Subverting Syria, How CIA Contra Gangs and NGOs Manufacture, Mislabel and Market Mass Murder. So he's actually a bit of an expert. He runs this thing now. His platform is called New Atlas. And so he's well worth following. He's I think, amazing. And he does everything from even though he's originally from the US, or originally a Marine, he's based in Thailand nowadays.
That's right. And so he's got quite a lot of insight into what goes on in Thailand as well.
So I'll put a full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Great to hear from him. I feel very sort of guilty, really, of not having him on more because, it's difficult to find stuff like this. Nowadays, lots of the, like I was talking earlier on about the Liar Politicians YouTube channel, many of these channels just get buried now. They get, you know, because of the algorithms, they're just completely buried. But anyway, on the similar subject to US hegemony, there was, I think, an excellent piece this week, which I contributed to, but you're not going to hear me, don't worry, on Press TV this week. This is the Iranian English Language Channel, looking at exactly this, and they entitled it The West's Multifaceted Hegemonic Agenda. And starring in it was a guy called Mohsin Abbas. And we heard him last week interviewing Sheikh Imran Hossein about this idea of the Pax Judaica. So we heard a little bit of Mohsin. But let's hear a bit more of him now, talking on Press TV about the American attempt to dominate the world.
Submission and domination, what the West seeks from Iran. This is according to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Larijani, who was addressing the We in the West conference in Tehran and reiterating the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Now, this is the reason the West opposes Iran's independence and strength and is not willing to compromise. A hegemonic force does not want ties which can benefit both parties. It wants domination and sees itself as superior and above the rest. And Iran will never submit to hegemony. Well, we're going to be taking a look at this on a spotlight, but first, let's take a look at this package.
Sharp criticism was directed at the West's hegemonic agenda, as the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Larijani, addressed a high-profile conference on Iran's relations with the West. He underscored that global relations are increasingly tied to raw power rather than principles of justice or cooperation. Larijani pointed directly at Washington's role in undermining international norms, saying the United States has replaced law with force. He warned that this shift leaves nations with a stark choice, surrender their independence or face aggression.
Mr. Trump insists on disrupting these systems and replacing international law with power. The meaning of this undesirable action is that general international rules are no longer peacemaking. Rather, power serves as a means of achieving peace. Therefore, countries have to submit to this power at the cost of their independence, otherwise this power will wage wars against them.
The words came with a clear example. Iran was engaged in negotiations with the United States when U.S.-Israeli forces launched strikes on Iranian territory. This sudden escalation revealed the true intent behind Washington's diplomacy, seeking submission rather than compromise. As images of U.S. complicity circulate and U.S. President Trump's posts on X resurface, the contradiction between talk of peace and acts of war becomes impossible to ignore. Larijani emphasized that Iran's policy has never called for severing trade relations with the West. However, the West's hegemonic behavior and political interventions have disrupted cooperation. He added that Iran remains committed to cultural exchanges, which should be based on mutual benefit and enrichment. Iran is neither hegemonic nor willing to compromise its independence, standing firm in its pursuit of sovereignty and self-determination. He then proposed a solution for when power replaces logic for the world's nations.
Countries express more resentment toward the United States. When the international arena turns into a jungle and power replaces logic, there's no other way for us but to unite and grow stronger together. They want negotiations for the sake of new kind of domination and submission, not for a fair compromise. Wasn't Iran negotiating when, all of a sudden, they started a war?
As power replaces diplomacy, nations are left with no choice but to resist and unite in defense of their sovereignty. Iran's stance remains clear. It seeks mutual respect and cooperation, not submission under the guise of negotiation.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. Your perspective, how important is this for those inside and outside of Iran to understand why the relationship between Tehran and Washington and other places in the West is the way it is?
Well, it's hugely important to talk about a vision and a dream that isn't one that is in lockstep with the current neoliberal, neoconservative, Zionist, Western imperialist one. There is only either the Chinese version of things, or you've got these American versions. The Russians have their take on things as well. So amongst them, I guess Iran is the only other one with an alternative vision. It's rooted in the Islamic Revolution. It's rooted in the principles of the Abrahamic faith. It isn't really an aggressive one. It's been a defensive one since the day it was born, because the Americans have created that situation. And the reality is that now Iran is faced with some existential reality. Jewish supremacy seems to be increasingly taking hold, Zionist Jewish supremacy, taking hold of Western political circles, not the people necessarily, but certainly the establishment. And you've also got, of course, the old school European supremacism, which hasn't really gone away from within the establishment, and US imperialism along with that. And add to it greater Israel plans, you know, everything that set out to basically subjugate and create servitude or create balkanization and war. That's the option which the empire is giving. And Iran is one of the few that is brave enough to stand against it.
Balkanization of war. Also, this. I mean, a lot of this seems to be centered, as we were hearing last week about this Pax Judaica, around the Israeli Zionist Empire, which has been created by America and Britain.
Well, I mean, we all pretty much know what the sides are now in the world war that's developing. And it's pretty clear, which sides are what. It's still not quite clear in the West whether it's the Israelis dominating or whether they are being used, but it doesn't really matter for people on the receiving end. We're on the brisk brink of major war, which will also have massive economic consequences.
I spoke to David Halpin a few weeks ago about the alleged Israeli use of nuclear weapons, and certainly they're not the hydrogen bombs or A bombs. These are all sorts of interesting, weird types of nuclear weapons, which involve an explosion which gives out a pulse of high energy gamma radiation, which will kill people. And this is talking about something called a neutron bomb, but various versions of this. And David Halpin wanted to point out that he saw evidence of this way back in the Iraq war. So here he is talking about what he thinks that he personally witnessed back then.
So this is Ali Abbas. He lost his arms. There was he was transferred to Kuwait, where they then removed an inch deep eschar, we call it, E-S-C-H-A-R, as surgeons. That was removed over his trunk, and they skin grafted eventually this large area of his trunk. His arms were amputated just below the elbow, just below the shoulder joints. It is very obvious, if you look at the images, that he was exposed in a rectangle, and I'm sure through the horizontally linear window of his fairly simple dwelling where he was living with his mum and dad. So I have assumed, and I think correctly, that this was a neutron weapon that was intense radiation. And what could have caused that without destroying the window, to be blunt about it, actually, was a neutron weapon. This was a weapon invented by a man called Samuel Cohen, who regarded it as a more humane weapon. Humane is inverted commas. The reason why he said it was humane is it kills instantly. There's a vast flux of neutrons from this weapon, which do not destroy. There's not a big blast, so it doesn't, in fact, smash. It doesn't smash buildings. It can penetrate metal and concrete and kill the humans being, so it kills cells, both animal and vegetable, but it does not destroy material. It has a very short blast radius, and it is highly likely that what is reported from the traitor by the three experts who are quoted in your report, it is very likely indeed that the neutron weapon was used. I've just been looking back. There's a massive amount of literature via Wikipedia, actually, on Cohen, on the weapon, on how it was cased, on the physics of it. But the key thing to read is the neutron weapon on Wikipedia. It's very complete. So it's a fusion weapon, where there's a vast flux of neutron weapons, which don't, in fact, radiate very far. Even the radiation is, in fact, limited.
That's Dr. David Halpin speaking to me a couple of weeks ago. So he's there talking, this is a fusion weapon. So if you think about it, fusion means atoms coming together, fusing together. Fission is where they split. So the atomic weapon, the atomic bombs used on Hiroshima, the standard ones were always a fission, which is an atoms splitting, but the really big bangs and the more interesting weird nuclear weapons are the ones where the atoms are fusing and the energy is released as a result.
Well, we also had Dr. Chris Busby, who is a physicist, isn't he, talking about
that's the report he's referring to, right, at the end there. He's saying that report on the crater at Hezbollah. So this is, you know, this seems to be developing a pattern. And of course, as I keep mentioning, Todd Ryder in his work is quite obvious that most of this technology was actually developed in World War II by the Nazis. They just felt at the end of the war, it would be better to trade the technology because it wasn't going to win them the war. They only developed it towards the tail end of 1944.
Well, I mean, that's a bigger question about the use of nuclear weapons in general. I think what they are doing is they're testing all of these kind of, you know, the wars that we've been having are a great opportunity for people to test all this stuff out. And the Israelis in particular test loads of stuff out, because then they can go to people and say, look, we've tested this out. Do you want to buy some of it off us? It's a way of funding what they do. And you know, Western multinationals, I mean, the British military have been quite a few times, all of our top military have been over to Israel several times during this crisis. You know, like we're talking, you know, 10, 15 times. It's all on declassified. So the idea that we are somehow independent and we're trying to sort of get the two sides together to get some kind of ceasefire in place, that's not the case. We've been locked in with the Israelis all along, and ultimately, of course, some young people in the British armed forces may pay with their lives as a result of all of this.
This idea of ceasefires, well, they talked about this in Northern Ireland for many, many years, and the only thing that actually brought about a ceasefire was the Irish Republican Army exploding a series of massive truck bombs in the city of London and doing massive damage to property, but hardly killing anybody by phoning warnings in first. So is there anything to learn from the IRA in how to actually force a ceasefire?
Well, what makes me quite cross, Tony, is that British military intelligence have basically learned from the IRA, they've learned the wrong lessons. So they are now teaching the Ukrainians how to carry out sabotage and an assassination inside Russia using very small resources. Yeah. So you don't need to have a big army. What you need is a small group that knows what they're doing, that can blow something up, shoot somebody or whatever. And therefore, they've learned all the wrong lessons from what happened.
So this is kind of guerrilla terrorism.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had John Stockwell a couple of weeks ago, and I just love him. You know, he's an amazing guy, ex-colonel in the Central Intelligence Agency. There was a big, big, big whistleblower in the late 1970s, 80s, 90s. I think actually maybe it was 1970s. Sorry, 1980s, with his book In Search of Enemies, which is still a classic, really. And so let's have a listen to his take on what the American mission really is.
Our enemies, our detractors, accuse us of being imperialists and being involved in neocolonialism. And it's always fascinated me because I've lived the life that they call neocolonialist, of in the big villa in a newly independent country with several servants and shiny new cars and jet planes here and there, while most of the people in the country have very little to survive, to live off of. And so this is the story. I wanted to write a story about ordinary Americans who live that kind of a life and what the life is all about and how it affects the people around them as well as themselves.
And where does it take place? What are the actual scenes and characters and actions?
I set it in Burundi, and I chose Burundi because it's
in Africa.
Burundi is in... I chose it because it's exactly in the center of Africa. It's as close to nowhere, so to speak, as you can get. It's also a very pretty place. It's right on the Western Rift Valley, right at the northern tip of Lake Tanganyika. And you have the Mutumba Mountains and the Virunga volcanoes and the Lake Tanganyika. And the city is actually up overlooking the lake. So it's a gorgeous little place. And as I say, quite remote.
Well, you grew up in Africa.
Well, I grew up in Zaire, which is right across on the other side of the lake. And then I served in Zaire with the CIA. These Mutumba Mountains that I write about in this book were a haven of rebels when I was in Zaire, but I also served in Burundi at one time. So we had problems with... the mountains were sort of an intelligence target, so we were covering them. I was sending people into the mountains, and I became fascinated with them. In fact, there were no viable rebels there. There was a great exaggeration of the rebel threat, because that's a good way to keep the United States and its aid interested in supporting your country. And I try to bring this out. There was a kidnapped threat that was brought to us from people across the lake who came into Burundi and said that they had information of a plot to kidnap the American ambassador. And this, of course, stirred us up no end, as you can imagine, flash cables to Washington and on a full-time alert and every security measure we could take. It turned out it was just a con. There was just some guys who wanted to squeeze a little money, a couple hundred dollars out of us. But then I was there in 70, 71 about when I left. But in 75, these same people did kidnap four European scholars working with a Caltech grant who were studying fish or something on the lake, and they did kidnap them and take them into the mountains. And so naturally, writing a novel about that area, I wanted to incorporate how a kidnap plot could work and what kind of people would do it and how it would affect the people in the city itself.
So that's actually, yes, John Stockwell, but talking about his novel, Red Sunset. He's doing a sort of fictional account there, because it's important for people like him to be able to write fiction, Martin, isn't it? Because then he could talk about things much more openly. This is the whole point, is that he's not breaking any rules, but what he's saying is fiction, and he can weave in a lot of secrets into that.
Well, that's one strategy, and the other strategy is to write a more conventional expose.
Which in Search of Enemies is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And finally tonight, actually, I've got a piece by Cynthia Chung here, but it's a bit long, so I think we'll do that next week, and I'm hoping to have an interview also with David Livingston about to do with Nick Land again, of course, but also looking at specifically at the accelerationist ideas and what their origin was, what they intend to do, what the holes in the argument are, etc. But it also in Montreal, because he's based in Montreal, there's a very interesting lady called Cynthia Chung. So we'll be hearing from her next week, from her and Matt Errett, who are part of something called Canadian Patriot Press, both of them consistently extremely good, and so I would certainly recommend most of the things that they do. And we'll be hearing next week from her about the Kaldanov Kalergi and the roots of the Crusader Revival. Very interesting. So we'll do that next week. But we'll finish tonight with Kim Carlson. Actually, Kim is on Facebook. She's fascinating. She puts all sorts of interesting things on there. And I've no idea who this guy is, but he's got a lot of interesting things to say.
If you're into real conspiracy and not alien lizards living on the moon, then these are the topics that you need to research and look into. Starting with privately funded globalist think tanks and foreign policy groups, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, the Club of Rome, Le Cercle or Cercle Panay, Zionism, Cecil Rhodes and the Roundtable Society, and the 1001 Club. Next, you need to examine the strongest political power of the last 1500 years, the Vatican, and its various military and intelligence groups, such as the Jesuit Order, Opus Dei, the Knights of Malta, and other papal knighthoods such as the Knights of the Golden Fleece. Attached and surrounding the Vatican are various bloodlines, including royalty and those of immense wealth. These are the Massimo, the Pallavicini, the Aldobrandini, the Bourbon Two Sicilies, the Habsburg, the Colonna, the Medici, and a few others. Next is secret societies and esoteric fraternities, of which not all members are bad, but the highest ranking and most influential typically are. So the Rosicrucians, or Fraternity of the Rose Cross, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, the Bavarian Illuminati, the Theosophical Society, Skull and Bones, Scottish Rite Freemasonry, the Memphis Rite of Freemasonry, and the Masonic P2 Lodge or Propaganda Due Lodge in Italy. Moving into the BC era, one must examine the mystery schools or mystery traditions of antiquity. These were the precursors to modern esoteric societies, so the mysteries of Eleusis, of Babylon, of Pythagoras, of Mithras, and so on. And the final topic I'll introduce is the satanic portion. So start with SRA, or Satanic Ritual Abuse, which serves as a form of mental programming. Then look into the worship of the Saturnian deity, the Black Sun deity, Moloch, Baal, Demiurgos, and so on.
So no idea who he is, but thank you very much, Kim Carlson, for sharing these sorts of things. And so we'll have a bit of Cynthia Chung next week and hopefully some David Livingston at the end of the show. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to David Halpin and various other guests, of course, including Nick Georges and Hedley Rees. Sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 and to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel and via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, please do donate or even set up a small monthly sub, just £1 even. Particular thanks to all that do that. So that's all at thisweekoneword.org.uk. My paperback about the deals between Churchill and the Nazis at the end of the Second World War, really autumn 1944, that's called The Traitors of Arnhem. Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, that's £15 for an actual paperback copy. Also, my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination, this is called The Siege of Heaven Reader. Both are on eBay, and you'll find The Siege of Heaven Reader ebook with my RT articles, plus my most recent on John Dee and the Empire at www.bilderberg.org. That's where they're linked from. This show's repeated at 11 on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on this stream. Do please make live recordings. We're streaming live from Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com. That is central time, midday till, or sorry, 11 a.m. till 2:30 in the afternoon, 97.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. By far the best way to do it. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. Do a good deed every day. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down. It is time for you to step out of the asylum. Yes, it's time for you to stop all of your sobbing. Oh, oh.
Black coffee, I see double. Ooh, ooh, ooh. How am I gonna get home? Black coffee, I'm so dizzy. Black coffee, please get busy. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Help me so I can get home. Had a little too much hoopy soup. All I meant to take was one. Now my head is going loopy loop. Some stuffy kid, what fun, oh. Black coffee, help a fella. Black coffee, what'll I tell her? Ooh, 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 I'm afraid to go home.